And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
No fear here on Declare Your Independence from here in Stancock, here in Phoenix, Arizona. Who do we have on? Mr. Adam Kokesh. And where's he at? Well, let's see. It's July 22nd. He must be in Hartford, Connecticut. Campfire tour. Adam, how are you?
Outstanding. Thanks for having me on, Ernie.
All right, let me crank this up, get up next to the mic or something here. Let's see. Let's get that up there. You know, this is, you guys are like the follow me couple. Okay, follow me around the United States of America. And oh, by the way, we're going to get married. Tell me everything about your engagement to Macy.
Well, whatever you do, don't follow me. you'll run out of gas pretty quick. We've had just the most incredible experience in our relationship. You know, we met on Twitter, and that was September 3rd of last year, and it's just been amazing since then. We've been on the road almost perfectly since then, living out of a 19-foot RV trailer together for 9 months, which is like, you know, 6 years regular relationship time.
Exactly. That's like being married.
Yeah, and I think it's better than being married. You know, a lot of people who aren't married, even, you know, if you work separate jobs but you live together and you have kids and you have, you know, a full life that doesn't involve your partner, you know, you might only see them like an hour or two a day aside from when you're asleep. And that doesn't count. But Macy and I, we work together, we live together, we work out together, we go to yoga together, everything. So, in a way we felt like, you know, we're already married. You know, just that's how we've chosen to live together and how to be together. So it wasn't really a big deal as a decision. And I actually suggested that we propose to each other at the same time. And it felt much more organic that way. It felt much more, true to the nature of our relationship. And, you know, I'm not, it's funny, a lot of people have kind of made a big deal out of it. And it's like, no, you don't get it. I just wanted a ring because chicks hit on guys with, like, wedding bands, right? Isn't that how it works? But we proposed to each other because we really just thought that was, much more in the spirit of what we were doing. And I don't have much of a, I don't read a lot of romance novels, and I don't really pay attention to, you know, the celebrity news that's supposed to teach us the ideal, you know, social conventions. And there seems to be something sort of disingenuous about, the man just saying, well, will you marry me? And, as if there was no prior conversation. You know, I think it's kind of primitive almost in terms of relationships. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with one person or another proposing to another, but I don't think it's really good to put someone on the spot when you know, as is sort of the, at least what I understand to be how it normally happens, is that when the dude is ready, you know, he pops the question. And I think, especially in modern relationships, it's much more often the case that couples are talking about it together. And that was certainly our situation. We've been talking about it together for a while. And you could say, I propose that we propose this way together. And Macy is a huge Beatles fan, especially John Lennon. So we did it in New York City in Central Park at the Imagine mural in Strawberry Fields. And there were a line of people there waiting to take pictures. So we stood in line with our rings. And then when it was our turn, we got up and we sat down in the middle of the mural, and she went first, and we just told each other what it meant to be making this commitment, and what we were asking each other to commit to being together for the rest of our lives, and it was a really beautiful moment.
And describe this Strawberry Fields thing. You know, in New York City, there's where John Lennon was shot. You know, I happen to have been in New York City, what was it, 80, 81, 80, I think, when he was shot. And I remember laying on the floor and hearing it on WABC. And within a couple of days, there was the big, giant Central Park gathering. And it was just 10 minutes of just silence and, you know, give peace a chance thing. It was amazing. And they built a monument there, or some kind of a structure that was the location of your engagement. Explain what that is.
Well, to start, for people who don't know the exact history of that, it was John Lennon, when you know he settled down with Yoko Ono, their primary residence was at the Dakota apartment building, which is right across from just on the west edge of Central Park. And he used to trip acid and hang out in the park right there. And what they did is after he died, they made a specific area that's right there across from the street from the Dakota designated as the sort of John Lennon memorial area, which is Strawberry Fields. So there's a section of the park designated as Strawberry Fields, and there's a place in the middle where three paths intersect, and there's no real structure. There are benches and fences and, you know, all the stuff you normally see in Central Park. But in the middle of this intersection is the famous Imagine mural. And, it's, you know, a little black and white tile, very simple thing, but it's become, you know, the ultimate memorial to John Lennon. And if I may, for those, we can ruin this beautiful romantic conversation with politics for a minute. You know, the lyrics of Imagine are extremely voluntarious and forward-looking, but a lot of libertarians take issue with, you know, Imagine No Possessions. And you could make the case that from this, you could imply or infer somehow that Lennon was an anarcho-socialist. And I think if that's the case, the only reason was because Rothbard hadn't been, gotten into his hands yet. I think he was very close to that. And as someone who's a much bigger fan of him than I am, Macy's analysis is that he, you know, as flawed as he may have been in a number of ways, he really represented a very powerful part of the human shift in consciousness and awakening. And throughout his entire life, I mean, obviously, first with the Beatles and with the transformation that the Beatles went through, getting psychedelic over the years, but, you know, in a much deeper way for himself personally as a leader of the counterculture movement, John Lennon really helped raise a lot of human awareness, and maybe not in a way that libertarians today would identify with, but in a way that I hope all libertarians today can appreciate the historical significance of.
Oh, no, for my, I was younger generation, you know, that, you know, I was born in 61, you know, I'm so that makes me, what, 13 in the mid-70s or something, you know, so I kind of missed. It was very popular music going on when I was younger, but I didn't have the emotional attachment that, you know, little people a little bit older than me until later. You know, I'm in high school, late 70s, 80s. You start to appreciate what they were able to accomplish. And John Lennon, there's a documentary called The U.S. versus John Lennon. And a lot of people don't know the Nixon administration was doing their best to try and deport him because they were so afraid of the influence he was going to have on the 72 election. And it was all about that battle. And he and Yoko were social commentators, you know, right behind me. If you look at in my studio, it says war is over. You know, well, that was a campaign that was done by John and Yoko. You know, it's war is over if you want it. And that had a very powerful impact on me, and I understand why Macy is, you just read the lyrics, you know, certainly John Lennon, yeah, you can see why she's attracted to it. I'm really glad you got to do that. Adam Kokesh, Adam versus the Man, the Freedom Line, you know, we're gonna talk about all these things when we come back, thefreedomline.com, go check them out. Then we're going to get down to his trip when we come back.
Uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. That's what the readers of FreedomsPhoenix.com get every day. FreedomsPhoenix.com constantly providing the information, the real news about government policies, and the real relationship we all have with the coercive government. The real condition of the economy, innovations in technology, breakthroughs in energy, health, and computer science. Learn the truth well before it's admitted to in the lamestream media. The corporate media, nothing more than distributors of government propaganda. But now there's an alternative. FreedomsPhoenix.com. Constant news updates on the issues that affect your life in the most important ways. With liberty and property under constant attack, FreedomsPhoenix.com provides the understanding behind the propaganda, and it encourages the participation of its readers. Go to FreedomsPhoenix.com. That's Freedoms with an S, Phoenix.com. FreedomsPhoenix.com. The revolution between the ears has already happened.
Okay, so this schedule that you have here, when you say tentative, what does that mean? Just waiting for someone in that area to sponsor a campfire?
Basically.
Okay. So that's one thing we should be pimping for?
Yeah, to tell people to get on the website and look at the calendar, and if you want, I'll run through the rough schedule for the next 2 months. I mean, it just kind of hit me last night, like, whoa, shit, we've got less than 2 months of this thing left.
Really? All right, so you have a time limit? It's not going to be your honeymoon, you know, on the road again?
I turned into a pumpkin in September. No. September 20th is about when we get back to L.A., and then October I'm taking the Earthship Academy and then finding a place to chill and either build a house or just write more books right away.
All right, well, that's one thing we'll talk about, too, is your concept idea of what you think you want to do and, you know, whatever. So,
hey, about that, just so you know, our exact plans for the workshop are kind of up in the air. The latest thing we were considering was, like, making it 1 month and pushing it back to June. So let's, if we can just, we can talk about, like, lifestyle and stuff that Macy and I want to do, but I don't want to talk about pitching the details because they might be shifting now.
Okay, well, you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. All right.
There's also a chance. Well,
we keep in mind we're recording, so, you know, all the breaks. I mean, I tell everybody, and they keep forgetting.
I don't mind. There's no secret. It's just like, right. I don't want to be selling something that we're about to possibly...
No, we're just going to talk about it. Here we go.
Ben.fm. Rhodes, it's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Okay. Campfire tour. All right, I know one thing. You know, Adam, Macy, they get married. It's going to be a party. So where would that be? And two, where you go for a honeymoon that you haven't been already? Okay, so go ahead.
I'm not allowed to travel outside the country until I'm off probation in January. So, hey, you know.
You're off probation coming this January?
Yeah.
They're going to let you?
Well, you know, I have court on Monday for probation violation, so we'll see. But
what was the probation violation?
Really, it's pretty funny, actually. My probation officer in California contacted my probation officer in D.C. To say that I had absconded from my probation and that I was in hiding and that my whereabouts were unknown. And I'm like, are you kidding me? My calendar is on my website. You can see where I am at least every other day for the last 4 months and for the next 2 months of our tour. Like, it's all right there. And I told him about this way in advance. And what actually happened is that, you know, before we started fundraising for this in October, like September last year, I told him what we were doing. Told him, like, hey, unless you're going to stop me from doing this, I'm going to start making commitments to doing this tour. We raised money October, November last year. And every month that I met with him, I told him, hey, this is coming. Hey, this is coming. The last time I met with him, I gave him a rough itinerary. I wrote it out. With names and numbers of people I'd be staying with along the way. And then he said, well, you need to come back and get some paperwork. And, you know, I kept trying to call him and schedule an appointment. I even went into his office once and he wasn't there. And so I was like, well, I got these commitments. I'm going to honor them. So I kept, you know, I just took off. And I haven't been in touch with him since then. So he sent a really, I want to say angry, but it was just with a lot of, you know, the kind of, you know, bureaucratese, spurious accusations that I've had leveled against me my entire life, like, you know,
yeah, blah blah blah.
History of firearms ownership. He has a problem with drug use and mental health, and you know he's obviously got problems with authority. So we recommend that you haul him back into court and put him in jail. Like that's really going to serve justice. And it's one of those things you gotta just dance through.
Yeah, I know. It's bureaucratic speak. It goes like this. Yeah, no, I get it. Okay. So what I want to do is go ahead and, so Monday you're going this probation violation, whatever, where?
Yeah, it's in court in D.C., and it's funny because I'm banned in D.C. as part of my probation. And, you know, apparently it's like this great threat to national security if I step into the district. But the judge has called me back to court. So we'll see. I don't think it's a big deal. Like, I'm really not worried about it. The main thing that I always underestimate government on is its ability to make things messy. And I mean that in personal legal terms. So, I have a feeling that they're going to change my probation terms and make things more restrictive or worse or whatever. And honestly, I'd rather they just send me back to jail for a couple of weeks and say, okay, well, that's the equivalent of the last few months of your probation and the money you owe us in court fees and fines. So, you know, then we can call it, it's done, and we can call it even and make it neat and clean and orderly and done with.
Are you going to have a lawyer go with you?
No, not for this one. They said in the summons that a lawyer will be appointed, new counsel will be appointed at this time. I'm hoping like that's not necessary, and I can just go in there and be like, ma'am, the judge is a woman, and be like, ma'am, this is obviously a misunderstanding. Here's my website. Here's the Indiegogo campaign. It's all out there. It's all public. I haven't broken the law. What do you really want to do with me? And we'll see what
death happens. Death to Adam. You must be in the hooshgow for because we can. I don't know. We'll find out. All right.
Even with that, like the longest they could even hypothetically send me away for would be the remaining 20 months of my probation suspended sentence. And that would be really, really unlikely.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. They won't want to explain it to you, I'm sure. But, it'll be another story that we get to tell. Yeah.
And every time I go into court like this, I always have all these great one-liners in mind. Like, oh, I'm going to say this, I'm going to say that. I'm like, no, that's going to get you sent to jail. But, one of them in this case is, Your Honor, as you can see from our website, we've been traveling around the country spreading the message of freedom, talking about how government represents an unjust, arbitrary authority that is violent and coercive. And I would love nothing more for you to prove me right in everything that I said by sending me back to jail for a little while.
Okay. And you never know, you might get what you asked for.
Well, it's when you stand up for what you believe in, you put yourself in a no-lose situation.
Well, tell me about, the trip itself. I mean, everywhere, whenever you've come here or we go see you speak at different things and so on, it always seems like you have a good time and everybody gets, a good evening's discussion and entertainment, and it's worth whatever time, effort, and money they put into it. How are they selected? I see the itinerary here, and it's like daily, 22nd, 24th, 25th, 26th, 31st, the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th. I mean, it's just, man, you guys are constantly traveling. And some of these say, like, you start getting into August, and it's like tentative. What does that mean? You're waiting for somebody to sponsor a campfire or something?
Yeah, well, we planned this tour, being a little over 6 months. And we didn't want to make precise commitments because it's such a huge logistical undertaking. But it's kind of cool to plan it as we go. And so we've got events, we've got some sort of guideposts logistically that we have to hit. And, like we had to be at Pork Fest. We're visiting my parents in Seattle, And so those are sort of like, there's some set dates and everything else around that is kind of flexible. And one of the things we did to raise money for this was offer deliveries. That is, for $100, we'll come and deliver a sign book and sticker and t-shirt to your home or place of business anywhere in the lower 48. So we've been going and doing those, and when we get in touch with people, it's like, hey, do you want to, I'm going to stop by your house tonight. You want to make it a house party? And they invite all their friends that they want to convert. And we've met a lot of cool people who were totally asleep that way, but because their friends said, hey, can you come to this and consider the message? We've actually, a lot of these events like that, especially those smaller ones, have been the awakening turning points for a lot of people. And it's been really cool to be a part of that.
Yeah, so, no, this is a powerful, you know, trip. And I'm wondering, you know, how's the book being received? Does it increase your, well, I guess not sales, but the use on the website and the downloading and stuff, how that's going?
Well, it keeps going and going and going. It's just building. You know, we're over 300,000 downloads now for all the various free digital versions of the book. There's, you know, probably a few 10,000 more now in the paid, semi-paid downloads as well that I got to count up and factor in. But you know, I'm not really worried about that because, you know, I know that the book is what the book is, as the most effective way to take someone from zero to I get it, and people are using it as such.
Yeah, no, we've had some cases that just keep, they go pretty quick. We go to a lot of different events and places and, you know, and sometimes we'll make them, a buck, something just to get them some skin in the game, make sure that they're going to read it, because it's a lot of good information, and Adam puts on a really good show. You should go check one out with Macy. We'll be right back. Hey, did you, I don't have the guy's cards. Maybe I got it on me. They're doing a movie called, the working title is Liberty. It's kind of a documentary on where the Liberty Movement go. And let's see, Jeremiah and Neil Rademacher. Rademacher, whatever. And then Jeremiah Rounds. And they were here till 2-3 in the morning last night. They interviewed me and Barry Hess as part of their thing, setting up all their goodies. And so their big concern is, you know, where is the unification of the movement now that it's the post-Ron Paul thing? And it's always about, you know, well, it's fractured, it's not combined, and it's not, you know, unified, and it's not. And I'm like, why does it have to be? I mean, you know, I'm just, what are you looking for? They're looking for an army. It's like, you know, well, Christ will need to be the head of and go smite our foes and, you know, whatever. And
like, no, that's not how freedom works.
You know, that's kind of what I'm trying to explain. I'm, you know, I did all, you know, the answer to the question is probably not common, but, you know, it's not anything we haven't said a gazillion times. Because my main thing is, it's a culture thing, and that's what I'm looking at. As you travel around the country, you know, you like here, people came from states away just the opportunity to come hang with the Adam. And I'm going, it was, I would say, not teenagers, but young, you know, mid, late 20s, newly awakened, kind of, you know, you appealed to them in one form or another. You were the conduit by which they came into it from Man versus the Man or whatever you were doing. And I'm going, that age, is it the same? Is it different around the country? Or you know, what's your audience that shows up?
Oh, that's such a league. I mean, it's really cool everywhere we go to have a different crowd. And I ask people, you know, I don't remember what my speech was in Phoenix, but I ask people now to start things off everywhere I go, what do you see people doing differently in their daily lives as a result of this? And you get, you know, the whole range of mostly homesteading answers, you know, conscientious information consumption, dealing with cops different, spreading awareness, blah, blah, blah. But people say, you know, growing food, you know, raising free-range children, you know, all of, you know, just living deliberately in all those different ways. And so it's really cool to see the cultural variation across the United States. But our audience definitely trends younger.
Yeah, when we come back, we'll go ahead and we'll focus on this future. You're going to do the white picket fence thing. You're off probation eventually. You get married, you know, whatever form that takes, you know, you jump over a broomstick or something. And I'm going, however that happens. But then I'm wanting to know, you know, kind of the concept of where you would make a decision to live and with whom and what and community and all that. We'll talk about that. As Don has been, we're looking around and kind of it depends what's important to you. You know, it depends. So this is, and one thing, it would be so much easier if government hadn't got into determining how and where you live under what conditions. They already set it up. It's like, yes, you can have the basement young man, but you have to have these conditions or whatever. So as a 17-year-old, you're going, hey, man, I was going to have stripper poles and stuff, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's we'll talk about it. Here we go.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock. To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800.
Go to the archive! That's the only way you're going to know all the secret stuff that we talk about. Okay, we'll summarize it a little bit. This is, Adam having gone through these phases, you know, of his life, you know, in his 20s, now his 30s, freedom and all the things that he's put under his belt. Then he meets young girl, Macy. Now, Macy, you know, just got it together. We had an interview with her without Adam. Adam and Baloo, go over there. You know, get outside the room. So we had her at Pork Fest. A fascinating story, you know, that, you know, how she came to her awareness. And I'm going, wow, this is a show. I mean, you should come on, sans Adam, and we'll just get down to it. So you go, you know, the Pork Fest week, a couple weeks ago, where we were, you know, had great interviews all week. And one of those hours was Macy. And that just was very interesting. I can see what you see in her. She's an awesome woman. Now, and she was having a good time, too. I think this is her first Pork Fest. She's like, ooh, party. So she had, you know, a lot of fun, made some friends. And of course, she's, you know, you feel my, you know, my circumstance when you have, and the better half is definitely the women, you know, so that you get invited only if you bring your wife. So what I wanted to talk about, as you go through this and you're talking to people, you're starting to see, I asked them in the break, are these people that show up for the campfire tours, are they, you know, younger, older, or are they a little bit different class? Because when we have Adam come here, you know, a lot of people come, but people will drive states away to come, you know, to Phoenix just to see Adam, and they're in about their mid-late 20s. And it was, you know, being awakened to something. And then I'm going, okay, now, how does that manifest itself as you start making life decisions, not just with who you're going to spend it with, but where and under what circumstances and how? How are you going to be able to exercise this freedom, you know, in an apartment building in downtown, whatever? Well, you can. You know, it's an attitude. You know, it's just a, you know, a perspective. But I'm there's a lot of intentional looking for places to go. When you go to Pork Fest and you have, when you go to Pork Fest and you have little children run around everywhere, well, they're in a safe environment. They're in a, you know, supportive. People don't want to turn you over to CPS because you let your kid go down across the campground to go water sliding on their own and they're 7. I mean, you know, or 9 or whatever. So I'm just going, this is one thing that you brought up is that you're looking to learn about living off the land or more intentional and having community and all that. Tell me what you're thinking and how that's being perceived by people.
Well, if I first start with, you know, Macy and I going through this process of what we want to do at the end of the tour, how and where we want to live, and striving to live by these values, we have learned so much from this tour and meeting so many amazing people. So every time I give a speech now, I usually start after telling a few dumb jokes that, I ask the crowd, you know, what do you see people doing differently in their daily lives as a result of this awareness of the message of freedom? And it's really amazing. It's so cool to see, like, across the country and different communities that there are different variations of this, but it's the same general trend towards striving to live by the values of freedom. And really the culmination of this, you know, the ultimate manifestation of this is homesteading. To say, I'm going to buy land. I'm going to build my own home. I'm going to live self-sustainably. I'm going to, you know, be completely off the grid. I'm not going to depend on anybody, and I'm going to, it's not about checking out or disconnecting, except from disconnecting from your relationships based on violence, and what happens then is your relationships based on non-violence are given a lot more space in your life. And so what we'd like to do, and you know, I've got a box full of construction books in our trailer here, and I've been ordering books from Amazon while we've been on the road. It's been a lot of fun. And Macy drives, I read. That's why she's the best. So
that'd make me hurl, man. I can't.
She protects me from the legal liability if I were to ever get pulled over and have to show ID or something at this point. But what we see, you know, when we ask this question, people give all of the answers everywhere. And you know, everything from growing your own food to unschooling your kids to not vaccinating to, you know, not paying taxes, buying your own land, living more free, interacting with cops differently, interacting with government differently, you know, drug use. Obviously, when you understand that just because the FDA or the government says it's okay, you shouldn't put it in your body. All of these things, you know, make for a comprehensive lifestyle that I think people are kind of groping towards piece by piece. And if you live in a city and you have a backyard garden, well, you can't have chickens now because it's going to piss off your neighbors. Or, you know, you could take your kid out of government schools, but now you got to worry about your neighbors calling CPS on you and having them taken away. Or, you know, maybe you figured out how to do most of your business by barter, but, you know, if you're paying rent, you're still paying a lot of taxes indirectly through that. So you can go from 100% status lifestyle and you know, take it apart in chunks and go to maybe like 85-80%, you know, if you're really good, get down to 70%. But the people who go, you know, screw that, I'm taking charge from the bottom up. I'm going to be the engineer of my own life, the entrepreneur of my own happiness. I'm going to do everything the way that I want to do and create that very deliberate lifestyle, you know, through homesteading. You can make the leap to the point where you're not living as a monk, but maybe your only interaction with the state or major corporations is, you know, that you pay your property taxes once a year. You've got your driver's license and your, you know, vehicle registration, if you want to do that. And, you know, then you get your packages from Amazon. And, you know, like that's, you know, you can really get to the point where you're not 100% or not 80%, but really closer to like 5-10%, and still be left alone and be able to live a happy, productive lifestyle. So we want to do a video series. We want to do workshops, and we're working on different forms of how to bring people in and help others, you know, make this complete leap to a totally different lifestyle. Although I can't say I've done it myself, except, you know, living in a box on the road for a year, which is a way of making a leap to another different lifestyle that a lot of people now, of course, especially retiring in America, are choosing to live mobile. But this idea of homesteading is really what's got Macy and I turned on to how we want to live and how we want to raise kids. So that's what we're going to be doing at the end of the tour. We're looking to buy land in northern Arizona, hopefully around the Flagstaff area where it's a little cooler, a little more rainfall. And I'm taking the Earthship Academy with Mike Reynolds in Taos in October. I'm really, really psyched about that. So, you know, it's cool to see that this is, you know, like any good politician, you see a riot and you jump out front and call it a parade. So I see these, the two important cultural shifts finally really taking shape in our movement in a way that everybody can look around and see. And one of them is this living deliberately and taking charge of your life. And you know, it solves this great contradiction in our movement where we say freedom is the ultimate good for human happiness, and then we sit in status lifestyles being miserable, complaining.
Yeah, but I heard in there somewhere something about children. I heard children. Didn't you hear the audience?
Oh, yeah.
Did you hear children? I heard children.
Oh, yeah. Children.
So what? So how many children? What are you talking about? When the children? You know, Macy's up for children. Come on, I want to hear everything.
Until her uterus is totally worn out and useless.
Hey, man,
babies.
You know, Arizona is used to, you know, Mormon state of I got 15 kids. If you don't have it in the teens, you're not doing it right. Okay, so this guy, you think I'm kidding.
The other thing that's even more important in terms of the cultural shift in our movement right now that I feel like I'm at least helping along with the way I'm talking to people and the way that, you know, we wrote this book and we're putting it out there as a tool is winning converts. And it's because people are sick and tired of winning arguments and winning debates and winning Facebook flame wars and winning yelling matches at the bar. Because you don't convert anyone that way. You don't create any value But when you go to someone and say, hey, I've got this perspective, philosophy, message, whatever, that, by the way, could solve a lot of the world's problems, but more importantly, has made me happier and more free right now. Would you like to hear about it? You don't get a lot of people asking about the roads.
You'll get a lot of people asking about the what?
The roads!
Who built the road? Well, I tell you, government built the road between Phoenix and L.A. You can't get there from here now. You know, a bridge went out, and we're screwed, man. I'm going, wow, some guys that came over last night to do some filming, man, they couldn't, had to go through Parker.
This is Donna Hancock with Silver Alliance Realty in Phoenix, Arizona, and I specialize in helping you find the real estate that fits your needs. Whether you are looking to purchase a home or a piece of land, whether it's in town or a rural setting, I can help you find exactly what you are looking for. Most of us are aware of the turbulent times ahead and will need to settle in a place that will suit our particular desires, not only to protect our families, but to thrive in the coming downturn of the economy. Unfortunately, that time is not in the future, but it is upon us, and if you are going to get ahead of the game, now is the time to prepare. Qualifying options for new loans are narrowing, the dollar is being devalued every day, and living expenses are on the rise. So I have created a useful tool on my webpage at DonnaHancock.com that will allow you to search for properties at your leisure that are of interest to you. Simply click on the Search MLS tab at the top of my webpage to begin your search today. Start preparing for your future, and when you are ready to move forward with your home or land buying purchase, we can work together to get you and your family ready to flourish. Feel free to call or text me at 602-828-1819. That's 602-828-1819. And let's get started today.
When we come back, we'll get into the criteria, you know, for this kind of thing. And I'm just, I don't know if I told you. I told you about...
Wait, what do you mean criteria for what?
You know, for doing something, going someplace, doing, picking
Land. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And what we have is the, did I show you the double axle boat trailer we have out there? There's a
double axle boat trailer. I think so.
There's a boat trailer that we had a boat donated to us. You know, a friend of our kids, the sons had, you know, project, and it was just a thing. So he's, you know, got in a relationship, girl moved in, get rid of all your crap, you know. So he goes, hey, can I dump my crap on you? And I go, yep, fine, it's mine. I want that trailer. And he goes, fine, do whatever. So we put it on Craigslist, and within 15 minutes, there's like seven people want that boat without a trailer. And I go, fine, go deliver it. Donna, you know, takes it, ties a rope around the transom to a tree in the backyard on cinder blocks, and a Filipino family is going to refurb it and launch it from, I don't know, Salt River or something. So I'm going, you know, that's their problem, but we got the trailer, and it's a galvanized, really nice trailer that's a double axle that we're building a solar power station on. Right. I just finished wiring the studio. We're going to be able to do... you know, I could just throw a couple panels I got on there and some batteries, and, you know, I could do the show. But my goal was to be able to at least produce enough energy that I can do the entire studio, the computers and the show and the broadcast, everything off the grid on solar for at least the 3 hours. So that's the we have it all wired, got it finished before we went on up the Pork Fest. And then now we're, I got an aquaponic system. My daughter Rhea and son-in-law Tam and their kids, they gave me $1,000 and said, all right, we did the math, man. We're spending way too much on vegetables, and they're all organic and everything. Pimp us out an aquaponic system. So Bob Anderson and I are working on that now. So we're doing the videos and everything and pictures, and, you know, we're going to start, you know, because we learned a lot. So we're going to, you know, incorporate the swirl filter and the SAM filter and this kind of automatic push-the-button, solar-powered, whatever the heck. So we're doing that. Now... we have the next phase, as we're doing that, is that boat trailer is going to become, it's like an accordion. You stack all of these solar panels, and you could just extend it out the back. So you just park it, boom, it becomes, it'll have probably twice the solar panels that a house does. So when I go somewhere, I am electrifying my life, not my house. Mm-hmm. So I get to take it with me. So I'm going, and I pull up, and I got my aquaponics little dome kit in there and solar power. And I'm like, who wants me in their community? Eh? Eh? Mm-hmm. Eh? And then, so that's kind of what we're thinking, where we're doing. All right, here we go.
Freedom is the answer. What's the question?
I want to break free.
You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
I want to break free. I want to break free from you.
Lies, the lies, the lies, the lies, the lies. You know, I'm that's why I want to break free. Just tell me the truth, you know, and we'll take care of it. Now, what we're doing, Donna and I, we decided to, you know, make sure that we can eat. You know, we have the aquaponics and the fish and the chickens and everything. I'm going, yeah, I'm feeling pretty good about this. That's a heavy supplementation of what we, you know, I juice a lot anyway, so what's the difference, you know? My daughter and son-in-law, they are spending so much on organic vegetables, they were going, yeah, we could have saved money if we just did an aquaponics system. So they got us working on that. Now, the other thing is we wanted to electrify our life, not our house. We want to power our life. So we have a double axle boat trailer out there that we've been working on. We just finished the right here outside the wall. I mean, like 3 feet from my hand right here is the entire integration and separate breakers off from our main power system that I take this one big switch and it goes grid, thunk, solar. And we're having all the connections there. Now we're building the power station. Well, you can at sunelec.com. That have warehousing, will call. You can get big pallets. I'm going to split with a few other guys. Pallets of solar panels for 32 cents a watt. And I'm going, and these are Samsung Sharp kind of some whatever the heck. And I'm going, this is solar is getting butt cheap, man. I mean, it is super cheap. And then you have
the. I've been waiting for that. I knew it was going to come. Just Nintendo when I was a kid. Like, you just give it a couple more years and the price will come down by about 50%.
Oh, it's been. I remember when Bob Anderson went out in Tonopah, it was $8 a watt and he did enough to run his home. Now it's down to under $1 a watt. You know, and I'm going, you buy in bulk, you can get it really stupid cheap if you do it yourself. Plus, the batteries are really starting to come online. You know, Tesla's Powerwall thing is just, you know, here we go. Then you have the inverter system. You get the top of the line, the uber-duber controlling of everything, and it then washes dishes, and it's about $3,500. So, for what would cost $40,000 a system, now you're $6,000-$7,000. And I'm going, you know, to power your entire life, that you can just take it around with you, when you create a community, that's the first thing. I got my power, and then they have these little, you know, meters that you can get on eBay for $14. I'll show you what it looks like. You know, those on video, you know, this is it. It plugs in, plugs out, and it measures all the amp hours and how much energy is used. So I take the power station up to Jackalope Freedom Festival, and I go, yeah, you want power? I'm charging 30 cents a watt. That's what I'm charging. You know, and here's your meter. So, you know, this is, it's kind of like Crosby up at Pork Fest. He's going, yeah, I got a, you know, you need to plug. So this is an opportunity that technology has given us the ability to bring the quality of lifestyle that we want with communication, you know, anywhere on the planet with, you know, heck, even our own networks with CubeSats and so on. We're able to communicate. We're able to provide our own power. We're able to provide our own food. And then, you know, you find water, you're all styling. Now, here in Arizona, a lot of people don't know there's a lot more water than they try and let on. And I'm going, okay, if you get the right place. Now, Adam is including the watershed, you know, how much rainfall that you can take. Yep. And then you're in the, you know, laws about you can't or whatever. But
hold on, Ernie, you think of all the people in the world, the government is really going to come after me?
Yeah.
Let's dance. But about the water thing in general, how I'm looking at this, like I said, I'm going to take the Earthship Academy in October with Mike Reynolds. If you don't know what an Earthship is, go look it up. It is a home built primarily from recycled materials, the main unit of which is the packed earth tire wall, completely off the grid and self-sufficient. And the main thing about it for water is that the roof is set up for water collection. Not that that's any major technological feat, obviously, but what then is the important convergence of all these technologies is you collect rainwater, you filter it, you compress it, it goes into your taps. Then it gets reused in your indoor greenhouse or aquaponics planter space. And then it goes into your toilets, and then it goes into solar septic and feeds a leach field outside. So if you use the water four times, even in a place like Taos, where you only get 15 inches of rain per year, which is less than half the national average, you're able to sustain two people in a you know, cottage-sized Earthship home when the water is used that way. So the places we're looking at in Arizona are mostly 20 to 25 inches of rain per year. And for the homesteading lifestyle, as I'm thinking of it, if you're set up for water collection and you have enough water to survive, you're good. If you want to get another 500 or 1,000 gallons into a tank trucked in every couple months so that you have luxurious overabundance of water, I think that's still, I think you're not dependent on anyone for your water for survival or for comfort even, but for luxury. And I think that opens up a whole other host of places you can live.
No, I'm familiar with this. In Tucson, just from roof water, they're able to, a lot of shows been done on, people we can talk to and so on, just from their roof water in Tucson, they can survive. The thing is, yep. is that you have more than enough water that, but I'm talking for big agriculture. And doing you have access to water. That's the, and then there's the infrastructure.
There is no big agriculture.
If I want to make agricultural money, there is.
Well, no. See, that's the thing. I want to be a farmer for my family, not for my community or for the world. So just to be able to sustain your own family. Hey, if there's not enough water for that from your one roof, okay, guess what? Build another roof.
Yeah.
Build a greenhouse that's built with water collection. Build a parking lot that's set up for water collection.
Well, this is the discussion that we're going to... Donna's working on a lot of different places and give the parameters of what is available. And that does determine the price. Because just like with communication and power, the technology of using water and collecting it opens up a whole bunch more land that is available. And because it doesn't have easy groundwater, it makes it really, really, really cheap. And if you're going to use technology to bypass a lot of these problems, like, well, it doesn't have phone line. Okay. It doesn't have internet. Okay. It doesn't have, it doesn't have, water. Okay. It doesn't have power. Okay. If you are able to develop it in such a way that you do it yourself, then all of a sudden, all these places that don't have that, well, here's a couple of hundred acres for $10,000. And you go, okay, thank you very much. We will take advantage of that.
And then you have the benefit of absolute privacy and near-perfect security from government agents.
Yeah, no, they don't want to bug you if they, don't have a water fountain. So, this is, as we go over a lot of places, it opens up a lot of places that may be arid, or not. I mean, some of these places have lots of pines and so on. They just don't have groundwater. So it just opens up. There's so much space in the Southwest, certainly in Arizona. Arizona, New Mexico, even parts of Colorado and Nevada, but it's it's very difficult. It's like the Bundy Ranch. I mean, they had to carve a little bit of heaven out of the desert, and then the man comes and wants to take it away. But
they carved a really big piece around the
Bundy Ranch.
It got the people's attention. If you want to just live free on your homestead, trying to graze a few hundred head of cattle might be a little bit of a liability that you probably don't want to take on.
Well, this is, the training that you're going to get in Taos. Tell me about the Earthship Academies there or whatever they're doing, because we've done shows on this before. What particular part are you interested in?
All of it. But this is something Macy and I have been geeking out on for a long time, and I'm reading a bunch of other construction books right now on alternative building methods. I mean, including traditional stick frame and how you would do that on your own, but it really is an inferior technology in a lot of these places if you want to live off-grid when you can have passive solar, thermal retention, things like that. So I'm looking at cordwood and underground and ceramic buildings and earth bags, super adobe. Those are my favorites, but Earthship is at the top of the pile. The only downside with Earthship in compared to some of those others is that it's a little more expensive in the way that it's put together, and it's a more complete technological package, but I think it's worth it. I think this workshop is a month comprehensive. You learn everything hands-on from the ground up, but our plan in when we find the land is we want to do the speed budget homestead challenge and make a video of this. I think we can do it for under $10,000 without the land and with free labor from ourselves.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you can't.
How easy it is.
The earth bags, you're talking about those like big long tube bags.
Yep, super adobe.
I really, really, that caught my attention. You can do a lot of funky stuff with that and get an enormous amount of mass. So I'm going, I'm really interested in you coming up after you go through that. When are you going to be doing this training?
October.
I'm definitely put us down for wanting you on the show after you do that. Cause
oh yeah, after, well we're coming after that. We're when we're hopefully we have the cash in hand coming to Arizona to look at property.
Yeah, no, we're looking too. We're gonna be we'll have a tour for you. You know, we'll go ahead and because we've been doing this for years and real serious for like 6-7 years. We've been going all around the state, but land opens
if
up when you have tech
for work.
Okay, this is let's go ahead and plan on after you get done with that, we'll have accumulate a lot of places. Donald will start sending you some things and give you an idea.
There are a couple of days in September. I'm coming to look at land with Peter and Grant. I think Donna knows about that. That's late September. But then, well, see, Ernie. Here's the thing. Are we off the record at this moment?
Can be. Go ahead and.
You got guests coming up. Call me. I'll be on the road or free later today, this afternoon. We'll talk like 5-10 minutes about what I'm thinking about organization and financial planning.
All right. But my main thing is I want my own private, mind.
I know that's a Grant. You're in touch with Grant and Peter on that, right?
Are those the guys that came by?
We'll talk later. We'll talk later. Enjoy the rest of your show, Ring.
All right, man. We'll talk later. Talk to you later, buddy.
All right.
Bye.
Please.
More Declare Your Independence is coming up next, live, after the news, here on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM.
What we're going to go ahead and do is, this is what's happened. Since we talked last, I've had Ron Paul on, Plowshares, Swords of Plowshares. I had an opportunity, kind of prefaced it this way. I went, you want to, hold on a second. What we went ahead and did is since we talked last, I had, and keep in mind, keep telling you, it's recorded during the breaks, okay? So we're going to have a lot of breaks and top of the hours and all that kind of stuff through this whole thing. So if you don't want it out, don't say it. We had Ron Paul on last Thursday, and I gave him an opportunity I even told him I was going to preface the question this way, how many generations I got to wait for the next Ron Paul kind of thing. Well, of course, that was open opportunity for him to support Rand and all that kind of stuff, but he didn't want to play. He didn't want to, talk about 2016. The guy didn't care, and I'm like, okay, that's all I need to know. And so he's really promoting the concept of anti-war. That's one of his main thing. He sees where that's going. And we had Charles Goyette on just yesterday or day before, and we talked about the European Union and Greece and economy and all this kind of stuff. But everything is centered around this drumbeat for another war, more war, and I'm not sure if anybody's even paying attention or care. And I need your perspective on what the issues are, who's doing. I give you an example. I had spent time with a gentleman that's very wealthy, does great. We've become friends over the years. We're out vacationing and chilling a week after Porkfest. And he worked in Ukraine and reads Russian. And he goes, I'll tell you, man, Putin's just handing everybody our hat, man. He's just he's playing long term and not a dumb guy. And their big thing, he goes, the reason that Syria is such a big deal all the time is as a land block from natural gas coming up from Qatar, going Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Europe, and then Russia.
We talked about that a little bit last time.
Yeah, that's of interest to me. And I'm wondering, what other issues there are economically. And it's always coming back to the banks and energy. All right, here we go.
Live. From the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
question to Mr. Scott Horton from Anti-War Radio is, how is it that you can immerse yourself in such a dark, global, evil subject of they, them, those that want to pummel the planet and mold it into their, I don't know, desires, and maintain any kind of sanity? I mean, I'm is there sense to it all? And we're going to be talking about, you know, wars and rumors of wars, Greece, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, Turkey, Yemen, Syria, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have here at home, and you're doing the Jade Helm thing and the PSYOP that is, and whatever is going on. I'm just like, you know, are we building up to World War III? I mean, this is how it happens. You know, if they, what if they had a war and just nobody went or cared or, you know, support? But then they just do robots and drones. I'm going, this is, man, not good, not good. So we're going to spend the next 2 hours with Scott Horton just going over all of this. And I'm just, you know, so welcome to the show, Mr. Scott Horton.
Thank you, Ernie.
What I need is, the first question to you is immersion in this subject. I'm wondering what kind of toll it takes on you, your psyche.
Well, you know, I don't really have feelings and stuff. I just, mostly it's interesting. And so there's satisfaction in learning new things. And then, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of horrible outrages. And so I try to be, in fact, that's probably one of my things is why I do this is because I don't really get desensitized. I get just as outraged, but I try not to hang on to it for too long. You know, I don't know. I have family members who are in medicine, and they see a lot worse stuff happen to people than I see. And right there in real life, they can hear the last breath. They can hear the screams and the grandma's grief and everything else. That's what they got to deal with. And they deal with it just the way doctors do. Just, well, all right, some of them don't die. We do our best kind of thing. So my
job. Do you ever have any desire?
I'm just sitting around looking at letters on pages. You know what I mean? That's nothing compared to a real job.
You know, that's a good point. Do you have any desire to go to any of these countries or to visit and kind of
get
it?
No way. I want to live, man.
Oh. We'll just talk about
it. I mean, I am honestly, you know, I've been talking to so many great journalists for so many years that I really do sort of feel like I pale in comparison to all of them. And how, you know, it'd be cool to be a real reporter, you know, but then I think about, you know, like Michael Hastings back when he was in, you know, covering Iraq and Afghanistan. I used to talk to him all the time and I used to think there's no way I'm going over there to cover these wars like him. I'm going to stay right here safe and sound in Austin, Texas, and I'm going to interview Hastings. And yep. Of course, he wasn't safe and sound even back here in the States, but that's a separate story. But anyway, I don't want to take those kinds of risks. And really, that's not my talent anyway. But what I'm good at is trying to keep up with a lot of different things so I can help you keep up with a lot of different
Amen.
Things.
Amen. Thank you. It's always good. I get to build up so many doesn't make any sense questions. And I go, it's time to talk to Scott. It's time to talk to Scott for 2 hours. I wanted to do this because your show comes right after this one. And so you stay tuned to LRN, and you can just go right into Scott. And the one thing that I'm hoping that we get is just some kind of a global understanding. I mean, there's China, Russia, you know, rattling their newly forged sabers and so on. We have the United States just being stupid as hell. European Union ready to implode. The economics ready to go. And then we have the Middle East thing that's just, you know, being stirred. And I'm going, is there any kind of a common link between all of these things in the news?
Well, you know, nah. I mean, it's one big world. And honestly, you know, the way that you portray it, it's pretty bad. And the truth is, you could elaborate, it's actually a lot worse than that in a lot of places, too. There's a lot of wars going on, a lot of strife. But on the other hand, I mean, you got to really be honest. And if you really want to take the third-person point of view as best you can, Kang and Kodos out in orbit just looking down, this is the most peaceful time in human history. This is the greatest time and greatest standards of living for the lowest livingest of people on the planet. Poverty is on its way to being abolished by savings, capital, and technology, new and improved distribution methods. And there are, you know, still governments in the way, but honestly, other than the American empire and the brutality that it is inflicting on people across the Middle East right now, and as you mentioned, in Ukraine and a couple other places, for the most part, the world is at peace. And there are, well, we're kind of waxing and waning on this a little bit now, but at least there for a time, there were only just a handful of outright dictatorships left on the planet, where every government, and I know I'm a libertarian like you, and democracy is no panacea, but, you know, it's nice to be able to at least try to have a say in who's your security force compared to just having, you know, like North Korea, where the grandson just inherits it from the father and this kind of thing. So, you know, it's really good times right now. And, you know, for a lot of people in a lot of places. And I think that, you know, nothing that you said is wrong. It's just in the larger context, there are a lot of peaceful borders in the world right now and a lot of peaceful states, you know, within those borders in a lot of ways. Most of the crisis that we see, most of the problems that we see are all generated in Washington, D.C. It's,
you know,
our
that's
central
one thing-
bank and our Pentagon that are ruining the planet. Everything else is, you know, going okay, sort of, at least, you know.
Well, that's one thing that, you know, a lot of people, it's obvious to them and they can see it, that the, if it wasn't for Washington and I don't know, whoever is controlling, I mean, it's they, them, those all over the planet. And if it wasn't the United States empire of aircraft carriers, it would be somebody else's. But, you know, I'm looking at that. I mean, heck, even Greece. You know, Greece, one of the, you know, they went a gazillion dollars in debt, and part of the deal was they were buying submarines from Germany. You know, I'm going,
right.
Wow, Greece?
Yeah,
I mean,
all
just,
new battleships and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, really? They got battleships and stuff too?
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, you know, for, I'm sure much of your audience knows this, but for people who are just newbies to this thing, there's an Austrian economist named Mark Thornton who has the skyscraper index. And he says, whenever a country or whenever you hear a country is building the next tallest building in the world there, you can be sure the bubble is about to pop. And this is what's going on with what's called the Austrian theory of the business cycle. It's not really the business cycle. It's the government's phony money cycle. And they build up a big bubble, and then there's a giant correction. And then they build up a big bubble, and then there's a giant correction. And so what Greece did at the height of the bubble was they just completely, they bought enough rope to just hang themselves and really blew it. You
well,
know,
come
America,
to find out, you know, there's some of the guys they're doing time.
Absorb the shock a little. You
they're
know?
Doing time in jail for this. I mean, it's billions of dollars that got, you know, indebted because they, you know, they, who's the guy that can sign on the dotted line to indebt the taxpayer? You, okay, you know, here's your bribe or whatever and sign here and that, and you go to jail and the entire country is impoverished and they debt slaves forever, you know. So this is kind of, you know, you look at Greece and that's always say, you look at a hologram, a, you know, you take a 8x10 hologram, you know, a glass laser etched 3D whatever, and you break it and you take the little corner, you don't get the bottom corner of the hologram, you get a smaller version of the entire image. It records the whole image. So I use that representation. If you look at Greece and you dissect what happened to Greece, you can see the world exactly what's going
to
happen. Same role, same players, same thing. Go to small towns. You go to, you know, you see the same equivalent of the United Nations or any empire. It's just the same. So if we dissect Greece, we're going to see what's going to happen. And that's what we'll do.
When it comes to investing in precious metals, you need a source you can trust who offers you choices and empowers you to maximize your wealth. That's where Roberts & Roberts Brokerage can help. Roberts & Roberts is a trusted name in precious metals. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts has been providing you with the finest gold and silver bullion, coins, rounds, and bars at genuine and honest prices. They make it easy to invest in precious metals and work with you to suit your investment needs. In addition to offering gold and silver for sale for U.S. dollars, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage is now accepting Bitcoin in exchange for their quality precious metals products. To speak with a professional from Roberts & Roberts about investing in precious metals, call toll-free 800-874-9760. Write this number down, 800-874-9760. Visit Roberts & Roberts online at rrbi.co. That's rrbi.co. On behalf of Roberts & Roberts, here's hoping your day is as good as gold.
What do you want to start off with when we come back?
Whatever you want, man.
All right. Well, I mean,
right there, you're talking you know, you started off big, the world empire, the world order, America.
Well,
Russia,
let's go ahead
China,
and go
Middle
with
East.
That. Let's go with that theme. Like what happened with Iran? How AIPAC is, you know, wanting to challenge
sure,
that
yeah,
and all their crap.
About that.
And then that'll segue in quickly into the 2016 election cycle. And then, you know, Trump's going to save us, you know, so we'll see.
You lead, I'll follow.
All right. Here we go.
If you enjoy LRN.FM, please contribute to your favorite shows via their websites and become an amplifier at amp.lrn.fm. That's amp.lrn.fm.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800. 602-264-2800. And now, Ernest Hancock.
You know, he's gonna save us. You know, I mean, you know, it's. I remember them talking about Bono being from U2 being head of the World Bank or IMF or some craziness like that. Do you remember that, Scott?
Wait, who's the head of that? I'm sorry, I took my headphones off because you were playing U2.
Yeah, see, that
all
was
that
my point.
Up during the break, and that was what you played.
No! See, I knew you'd say something. I'm going, weren't they going to make Bono head of the World Bank or something at one time?
Oh, who knows? I don't know, man.
Yeah.
The sun.
Donna, look that up. Bono,
let me know when they shoot him into the sun. Otherwise, I don't want to hear anything about it.
Yeah, Bono World Bank.
The worst band in the history of mankind. And to all of your audience who's insulted by me saying that, good. Ha ha, your favorite band sucks. Hate them.
Well, okay, why? It's not because of their music. It's because of their philosophical.
Yeah, it's the music. It's just horrible.
Really? Nah, there's a lot of stuff I like there. But, you know,
if I get that song stuck in my head, I'll tell you what. Well, at the next break, I'll go ahead and fix it.
I'll rock you out. I'll give you some, you know, classic or something. I'll make you feel better. You know, like, here, I'll purge it for you. Here we go. Yeah, see, let's make you strip anything else from it. You know, all right, here we go.
That's not my favorite. I'll settle for seven.
Okay. So now you're purged. All right, that makes you feel better. All right. Now, what we'll go ahead and do is I wanted to, how would we go ahead and start this? Do we go small in some place or do we look at the overall empire? And I'm going, okay, let's take a look at the empire first, because now we have Obama's coming out and he's going to go, oh man, look at my legacy, man. We shut down this and we did this and peace that and gotten kind of whatever. No, by the way, we're taking care of all that gun control stuff. So I'm just going, all right, there's getting a treaty or an agreement, or we're not going to bomb you this week with Iran. Probably better than not, you know, but, you know, AIPAC is now setting up their own separate lobby group. It's like, we don't, not just AIPAC, we have AIPAC on steroids, you know, to get the congressman against them. Well, hell no, we're not going to have this peace with Iran thing. Go ahead and try and deny, you know, Israel, the third rail Israel their due, and see what happens. Well, we're going to hopefully see what happens when you, you know, kind of go up against the Israel lobby. So I'm just going, all right, so this deal with Iran, good, bad, whatever, we'll talk about that. Then we have the empire as it's, you know, extending its fingers and tentacles into everywhere. And then that take us right into the 2016 election cycle and how much, you know, Trump's going to save us. And he got, I watched two of his speeches, Freedom Fest in Vegas and then in Phoenix here just a couple weekends ago. And I watched the whole things and I'm going, I've been through this before. This is a Perot thing. You know, I got billions and I can say whatever I want the way I want. And this is what I want. And I go, all right, fine. So what do they want? Freedom for individuals? No, it's about the deal. And the deal is that, you know, well, I didn't like invasion of Iraq, but they have a bunch of oil. And we should just claim it, it's ours, and we should get the oil because we went and spent a lot of money on oil. And ISIS needs to be, you know, obliterated, and I'll just go kick ass, and China will just slap them around. So I'm just going, wow, man, this is, you know, as time goes on, he gets challenged in any way. Certainly if Ron Paul was there, it would just be a love fest on our side, just slapping him around and you know, having some fun with it. But Rand, He's going to try and out-immigration him. He's going to try to out-conservative him. He's going to try to, but not really based on principle. So I don't really see that going anywhere. So I'm just, so I'm looking to get Scott Horton's perspective on this. And let's start with the agreement with Iran to not bomb them this week. So what do you think is going to happen with that, and how AIPAC going to handle this?
Well, I think that's a great name for it. I mean, that basically is the deal. Iran isn't changing too much of what they're doing. I mean, they are vastly scaling back their civilian nuclear program, but they're not changing it from a weapons program to a civilian one. It never was a weapons program. So we're paying them to continue to not make nuclear weapons. Thanks. And what we're doing in exchange is actually not outright giving them a security guarantee and promising not to bomb them. But we're, our side is basically taking war off the table, because by our side agreeing to the deal, that means we're satisfied that their program is peaceful and not a nuclear threat. And that is the big fake casus belli for a war. And beyond that, it's the worst big fake excuse for the Cold War between the United States and Iran. So you're absolutely right to call it the, you know, America backs down from its threats for a change deal this week. Although I think it's going to last a bit longer than that. I think it's a real good deal. And in its basic outline, here's what you need to know about what Iran's going to do. They have two enrichment facilities, Natanz and Fordo. Natanz, they have 20,000 centrifuges spinning. They're going to reduce it down to 6,000. At Fordo, they're not going to be using nuclear material in any centrifuges at all. They're turning it simply into a research facility. Then they have a reactor at Arak, A-R-A-K, that they are converting to make it where it's impossible for it to produce weapons-grade plutonium as waste, which they don't have the facility to reprocess into actual weapons material anyway. But this is just double extra super making sure that there's no way that weapons-grade material will ever come from that facility. And they're expanding the inspections regime to... I mean, they already are safeguarded and inspected at all their nuclear facilities, but they're expanding their inspection regime to permanent on-site inspection presence at their factories where they make the centrifuges, at the mines where they dig the uranium ore out of the ground, et cetera, et cetera. So they're expanding the regime beyond all reason. And then in exchange, the Americans, the EU, and the UN are lifting the sanctions, not all at once and whatever, like you hear in the scaremongering propaganda. But as the Iranians implement their end of the deal, our side is to implement its end of the deal. And yes, all things being equal, it is the right thing to stop doing the wrong thing. And our government has been lying like mad in order to justify this Cold War against Iran, this sanctions regime against the people who happen to live under the government of Iran. Who have been suffering and under the sanctions, the war on their economy, and they're doing the wrong thing. Now, what all it's going to mean for the region, I don't know. I mean, it could be that the discussions in the capitals of some of our, you know, Gulf allies are saying that, you know, they want to do this, that, and the other thing that are going to harm our interests eventually, or at least the empire's interests. As revenge for this, or because they think that America's abandoning them or whatever. So who knows exactly what the future is. But, you know, any claim by Saudi or Israel that now they have more reason to fear Iran's nuclear program is a ridiculous joke. And what they're mad about is that Iran will be free from economic warfare and will become a more powerful actor in the region.
Oh, what did I tell you? What they're mad about is that you got, like, Iran saying, hey, we got a deal, and it's, like, a good deal, and we win. No, you didn't! You need to tell all your people that we kicked your ass, and that you're ground into the desert with our boot heel. Damn it! Tell them, we win! Why? Yeah, see, that's the one thing that I'm seeing, is that, you know, God, look what, I always see all over the internet, look what Iran is saying. They're saying they kicked. Well, of course they. What the hell you think they're going to say? You know? And I'm just. And here in America, they're going, instead of saying, you know, we got a deal, we're not going to go to war this week, you know, no, we got our ass kicked, and we need to have. 2016 election politics. I, you know, just see it coming already. And it's always been, now remember the last two election cycles, they don't have, I guess North Korea, they don't want to mess around with because he actually got ICBMs. And then, they don't have Iraq to kick around anymore. And little countries like Libya and Yemen aren't worth it. So Iran becomes the whipping boy. I mean, you know, they become the face of, you know, all things evil, and we got to have some evil, we got to go after it. But usually it's in threes. And it, when you had the Cold War, it just, you blame Russia or maybe a little bit of China. So now it's, I'm wondering who the three are. One, it was Iran. They kind of take that off the table. Used to be Cuba. Well, they're open embassy in D.C. We have trying to resurrect the Cold War, I guess. And who are the others? I mean, it's usually
we
comes
got a pivot
in
to China, and we got a full scale invasion of Africa too. So I think it's four because you got the Islamic State.
Okay, Africa. Where, I mean, I know they started up AFRICOM. So on what's their little, you know, landfall of a whole bunch of Marines in Africa?
Well, mostly what they're doing is intervening with drones right now, as far as active battles. But they've got special forces. In almost every nation, they're training up the militaries of the various nations there, and they're finding some work to do, I guess, mostly fighting internal enemies. But Nick Turse has talked about how virtually every nation in Africa now has American forces either fighting them or fighting with them.
Chinese,
it's all European borders, so you have multiple tribes within arbitrary lines, and so there's always some kind of,
yeah.
I guess not always, but in many cases you have, you know, real fights over who rules the capital city, that kind of thing.
Well, it's like, you know, Turkey, Kurds, Iraq, Syria crap. I mean, you know, they just throw these lines down and they go, hey man, my uncle lives over there.
The same thing with Afghanistan and Pakistan, too,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so this is these, and that's a good way to put it. We'll come back with that concept, these European lines drawn all over that. Oh, I got to tell, yeah, let me write this down, remind me. The point that I wanted to bring up, take us where I want to go on this. We'll go to Africa. And I'm wondering what China's opposition, because they're in Africa too, they're doing a little bit different. They're just bringing a checkbook, you know. But
yeah, exactly. They send guys with briefcases, which, by the way, before we do Africa, though, when we get back, we need to talk about AIPAC and their effort to disrupt the deal and the end of the 20, because we talked about the Iran deal, but we got to talk about what they're trying to do about it.
Okay, we'll do that.
Because you brought it up.
And then
I'm taking notes,
right,
too.
Here we go.
There are those that just want to be left alone. And those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Yep. A little Led Zeppelin never hurt Scott Horton. He's just going to have to cope. You know, this. Can I get some Led Zeppelin for you there, Scott? You okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they really were the first boy band, weren't they? But but they're not. They're better than you two.
Yeah.
For God's sake, man.
All right. So
let me some more of that AC/DC.
I got some AC/DC. We'll hook you up. All right. Now, this is the one thing that we want to finish up on AIPAC, but there's some other stuff I want to get to. But AIPAC is American Israeli political action.
Affairs Committee.
Yeah, we, you know, whip your ass with money that you gave us from the State Department that we bought congressmen with, kind of stuff. So I'm going, okay, so what they're going to be doing on the Saran, they've announced it. They go, look, man, we're getting into the 2016 election cycle. We got a bunch of money over here. Now, who wants to line up and tote our opposition to this bill? So tell me about the plan.
Well, they've already lost. And, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likudniks, and that means the American Israeli Fifth Column, the neoconservatives, AIPAC, and their associated organizations, they're just blowing it here. I mean, they're really, you know, all of the liberal Zionist Jewish organizations have come out in favor of the deal. it's really only kind of the Israeli government and the most right-wing factions in the Israel lobby here. And all they're doing is just, you know, as a matter of quote-unquote principle, from their point of view, I guess, they're committing seppuku, man. They're willing to go down with the sinking ship here. And there's no way they're going to override the president's veto. They have to pass a law to ban the deal, to nullify the deal.
Well, they won't nullify it.
They can do that. They control both houses of Congress. There's no way in hell they're going to override the president's veto, that they're going to get that many Democrats to line up against the president on this, even if they do threaten to primary him. Because, you know, crossing the president isn't a very good reelection strategy for your House seat either, not on his signature accomplishment, et cetera, et cetera. So,
well, the Democrats and Republicans come together when it comes to doing a Trans-Pacific partnership of giving executive authority and transferring of somebody else gets to rule us kind of crap. I mean, they don't have a problem with that, you know. But when it comes to peace, they're like, oh, no. So it's going to be.
Look, here's the difference, though, is this is the president's deal. And he's still the emperor of this place for another couple of years here. And he's still the leader of the Democratic Party. And you're right. I'm not used to seeing a president or any American politician take on the Israel lobby like this. But Obama decided at some point, I don't know, he put it off long enough. He could have had a deal along these lines way back in 2009, even at the beginning of 2010. He had asked the Brazilians and the Turks to do a nuclear fuel swap and all of this. And then when they accomplished it, Hillary Clinton hung them out to dry. And basically stabbed the president in the back on it, and he didn't say anything. He let that stand and let the deal die then. But anyway, at some point, he decided that, you know what, I don't care what Benjamin Netanyahu wants. I've decided that this is the deal that I want to do. I'm going to take the nuclear issue off the table.
You know, this has been
between us and Iran. And at the end of the day, Israel is just a crappy little country over there on the American dole. They are not the empire. America is the empire, and they're the little satellite state. And they're not even our ally. They back our enemies. They don't back our friends fight our enemies and back our friends over there. They're the cause of all our problems over there. So when it comes to a real test of wills between the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Israel, tough, Netanyahu. What are you going to do about it?
You know, I'm not, well, they're doing it. You know, we're going to, like, you know, rule some more congressmen, but, you know, at least try. And the thing that it struck me even in high school when I saw how much money we gave to other countries in the State Department, and you see the billions that go to Israel, and then they just use the money that we give them to come back and buy congressmen to get more money. So I'm just going, wow, that's a sweet deal if you can get it, you know? So yep. I look at this this battle between Obama and Netanyahu, and you look at how they really, because Netanyahu and friends are all this neocon Republican, let's go start some war somewhere, and to have a black Democratic president up there, I don't think he'd like that none too much. And Netanyahu has showed a lot of disrespect to Obama, and I kind of got the impression that, you know, this was part of Obama's plan from the beginning, because he did have sympathies towards, you know, the Muslim nations and all that kind of stuff.
Well, he ran on peace with Iran in going back to 2007
but he
and 2008.
Waited.
And this was one of his things.
But he waited.
In fact, when he first took office, he gave the New Year's greeting to the people of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was the first time an American had recognized the legitimacy of their revolution, etc. So,
but he waited. I mean, why?
And like I said, yeah, I mean, he had a chance for a deal in 2009 and 2010, and instead he put it off till the end.
Why?
Yeah. Well, because he's scared of the Israel lobby. He had upcoming midterms and then an upcoming re-election of his own to deal with, so he decided to kick the can down the road.
So do you think
at least he finally did it?
Well, although, I mean, is peace going to be an issue in it's Democrats or the peace lovers, you know, versus, or did Hillary Clinton all of a sudden decide she didn't want to bomb Iran anymore?
Well, you know, I mean, this is the thing. Gareth Porter pointed out on my show the other day that, hey, you know, the narrative of the ultimate evil of Iran is still out there. And so, you know, and Obama, in fact, has used it to say, I know, that's why we need the nuclear deal so bad. And so, you know, he could have cooled things off a lot more than he has. And it's counterproductive resorting to that kind of narrative. And all the rest of the presidential candidates all agree with that. On the other hand, by the time in November 2016 rolls around, they'll have been abiding by the deal for a year and a half. Well, a little more than a year anyway. And will have been implementing it. It will have been a success so far by then.
No, they're going to say they violated and this guy in Curveball came out and said, and I got polarized.
It's going to take the IAEA to say that it's been violated. And the IAEA says what the U.S.
Oh, you mean like when the IAEA said there wasn't a problem with Iraq and they went anyway? You mean like that?
Well, yeah, but they went anyway because the Americans insisted. Which is different.
And they're going to not insist this time.
Well, at least until Jeb comes. I mean, once we have an election, I don't know. Once the administration changes, I don't know. But Obama certainly is not going to be using the IAEA to hype up Iranian breaches of the deal in order to try to scotch his deal and make a fool of himself for ever making it in the first place. I mean, that's for sure.
Okay, Donna is updating. We keep talking about it. She's going to update it because she pinky swore she's doing it now. That we have a Republican and Democrat presidential list that keeps getting longer and longer and longer. And I'm going, all right, who's rising to the top? You know, where's the foam? Where's the scum?
On the Republican side, it's Jeb Bush. Everybody else is a nobody. And then there's Jeb Bush. Well, but then there's Donald Trump. Now,
Jeb raised $100 million just to say he did. And then Trump is like, yeah, I got $10 billion. I trump your $100 million. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and
your $100 million. I like that.
And you know what? The red state fascists, as Lou Rockwell called them, you know, these Tea Party guys, they forgot all that stuff about liberty and fiscal responsibility. And what they really want is to be able to identify with the people in power using violence against people they hate, which means homos and Mexicans and whoever else. And so, you know, give them a chance at power. Same with the liberals when they have power too, and see whether they side with the libertarian part of their ideology or the authoritarian side. And here Trump is saying, like, you know, here, live out your most fascist fantasies through me. And they love it. He's at the top of the polls right now.
Yeah, we're going to whip ass. America's going to be
exceptional
again.
Love it.
We're going to be exceptional. Exceptional America with a comb over. You know, so I'm going, all right, we're going to see how this goes. You know, I'm wondering, what's Jeb doing? He's just, you know, sitting there on his money, just waiting, letting everybody
else. Just waiting for
that. And what's Hillary doing? We're going to find out. And who else is on the Democratic side? We have General Wesley Clark wanting to put everybody in an internment camp.
This is Charles Goyette, author of the New York.
Yeah, that's one thing. Wesley Clark, let's make that point, too.
Yep.
Well, that's Clark. You know, this, you know, I mean, if they don't eventually show their stripes. So, and this is from the Democratic side. Who are the other Democrats that are, I mean, a guy, what I got, Bernie Sanders and Hillary, and that's it?
And O'Malley and Webb.
So, yeah. Jack Webb?
Jim Webb,
wasn't he a senator or congressman?
Yeah, he was a senator, and he kind of had a reputation as an anti-war guy, only he's come out against the Iran deal now, so.
Wow!
He's kind of the Rand Paul of the Democratic side.
So what's Hillary's deal?
A lot of people had hope that he would be principled, and now they're bummed out.
Well, what about Hillary? Is she pro-Iran deal or no?
Well, yeah, but just barely. I mean, she was this president's Secretary of State, and so she can't. It'd be really difficult for her. Real ugly of her to denounce the deal. But so she's really hedged and said, yeah, you know, I'm for it. But we can never forget just how evil the Iranian government is. And they're the world's greatest sponsor of terrorism and all of her little, you know, slogans and red herrings. As though Saudi Arabia and the United States of America aren't the biggest supporters of terrorism in the world. Give me a break.
I'm wondering
Iran,
what her difference...
because they support Hezbollah? Give me a break, dude.
What's the difference between Hillary and Jeb? I'm wondering where the substantial difference is.
I'm trying to think. I guess he probably de facto would be better on guns. He's probably like Junior. He'd not be likely to do affirmative gun control measures like Bush let the assault weapons ban expire. So he might be better than her on that, different than her on that.
Well, I guarantee both of them.
I can't think of anything else.
Yeah, I mean, they're both going to be this domestic, we rule you, you know, it's coming home, we all durka-durka jihad down the street kind of stuff.
He's a compassionate conservative, all right. I mean, he is a centrist George W. Bush, you know, Ted Kennedy Republican, no doubt about it.
Well, what was his final legacy on being governor of Florida? Did that, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting there because I think he has a reputation of he abolished some government offices and scaled back some things. He did some things that, you know, are not good enough for you or me by a long shot, but make for pretty good talking points for being a conservative governor with a conservative record of scaling back this and cutting costs.
Sorry, he's making sure.
I think there's probably a lot of smoke and mirrors there and a lot of transferring funds around and whatever, but. I think, you know, he'll be able to claim that's his strength, really. He'll be able to claim that he has a conservative record as governor as his strength in the primaries. But then he'll be able to claim that he's Mr. Compassionate Conservative centrist like his brother in the general election. And who else do they have? Huckabee and Kasich? I mean, give me a break. There's nobody else on the Republican side. So it's him. And then I think he'll beat Hillary because I don't think anybody likes Hillary.
I don't trust the system.
Hillary comes even more than Jeb. Hillary comes with a you have to vote for me kind of thing. And I think people just rebel against that. Even regular normal people.
I don't trust the system representing what people are conned into to begin with. But
well,
you know,
no, I mean that's
I
true.
Understand
I'm
your
saying,
point.
On the when it's basically a 50-50 split and you're going for the swing voter. You know, I think she just has too high of negatives. She just rubs people the wrong way. She's just too ambitious, and people don't like that. You know, she's like the bossiest lady down at the PTA that everybody goes along with because they have to or whatever. You know.
Well, no, I'm seeing that. You know, that this, you know, it's Clinton Bush. Who? What's the difference? You know, the same guys are in charge, and I'm going. Okay, so what is going on? Well. You ought to be happy with Jeb, or you could have had Hillary, you know? So I think that's the attitude.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
All right, a little bit of AC/DC, you know, for Scott Horton's mental health. Scott Horton, antiwar.com radio, antiwar radio. I'm just, I'm looking, you can catch him here after the show on the LRN.fm network and, of course, their archives. This is, I'm really glad that, you know, we tag team each other here because I think people, it gives them a reason to listen to the network and kind of get a daily dose of. And I don't emphasize the war thing. Well, because you're there. I mean, you know, the one last thing I got to do. But the I like talking to Scott Horton on a regular basis because he gets us up to speed on what the heck's going on. We're going to have him for the next hour also. But one thing I wanted to bring up, we have one of the former Democratic primary candidates was General Wesley Clark. And he just came out saying, hell yeah, we need to have FEMA camps for political dissidents, don't love America, and put them in jail, America. And I'm going, wow. I mean, I didn't even have to scratch the surface to know, you know, yeah, what'd you expect? But what do you know about that, Scott? What's your opinion?
Man, that's really something else, isn't it? He just came right out. And, you know, this is part of the thing, man, that people really got to understand about the costs and consequences of having a war go on for this long. We really do have some of these lone wolf attackers who aren't just put up to it by the FBI. Now, believe me, I'm the first one to tell you, and I've been saying this since the very early 2000s. Hey, look, this guy was entrapped by the FBI. You know, I was even going to write a book about it. So although no one would give me a book deal for it. Anyway, that's a thing. But there have also been some lone wolf attacks. And they say, well, we fight them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here. But the truth is, when our government is just slaughtering people for generations on end over there, there are going to be people on the margins here who are alienated enough from American society, which, of course, another aspect of this is the constant demonization of Muslims and of the Muslim religion as though it's the cause of our problems, not blowback and consequences from H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton's policies in the 90s and then George W. Bush and Obama's policies since then. But no, it's their Islam that makes them hate us. And so that's led to, especially in the Obama years, because Bush kind of kept a lid on it by denying that kind of thing and saying, you know, no, it's not Islam. It's these people who pervert the great religion of Islam or whatever. But once he's gone, it's gotten, you know, way more bigoted against American Muslims. So you got American Muslims being more and more, you know, alienated and marginalized, whereas before they were very well integrated. And because most American Muslims, or especially Muslim immigrants, are from higher classes and come here, you know, with educations and get professional engineering degrees and these kinds of things. So they live in nice houses and they, you know, have good jobs and are very well assimilated. It's, they don't live in ghettos like in Europe, where the Arabs are kind of the Mexicans of Europe, where they live in poor barrios and are sort of kept out and separate from the rest of society and that kind of thing. It's not American Muslims' experience for the most part, but more and more, sorry, I'm trying to get to the point, Ernie. More and more, they're being scapegoated and blamed and made to feel alienated from the rest of American society, right at the time that the American government is still over there bombing people to death. And you're going to have on the margins, it's very, 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 very few people so far. And every reason to think it'd be the slightest percentage of American Muslims would ever participate in this. But some of them are going to decide that they identify more with America's government's victims than the American people.
You know, that's
or
one
the
thing
American
I want.
Government where they, you know, in the country where they live, and they're going to join up the war on the other side.
That's one thing I want to bring up is Africa. You know, primarily, I would imagine there's a lot of Muslims in Africa. And you start taking on Africa, the dark continent of, you know, you don't want to. And I'm going, that is going to be interesting in how we're perceived there when you have the Chinese, instead of coming in with a drone strike, they're just walking up with a briefcase and a checkbook. And I'm going, this is interesting how this is going to play out. Talk to us about AfricaCom, what's going on with the drone war and how it's expanding in Libya and Somalia. I mean, it's just we're getting a toehold on the dark continent and here we come.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm sorry, because I went off way too far on that tangent, but I wanted to get back real quick to Wesley Clark here. So we live in an era where we do have these kind of lone wolf attacks from time to time anyway. And now that we're, you know, 15 years into the terror war, it's perfectly natural for a Democrat, as you said, former presidential candidate. He is a general, former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, in fact, where he just, if you watch the clip of him on MSNBC, he says it like it's no big deal at all. The MSNBC host doesn't notice that it's a big deal at all. That's the end of the interview. Okay, thanks very much, General. No follow-up question. Just, yep, I guess this is where we're at now. And he describes the kind of people that need to be put in camps. By implication, he's talking about Muslims, although he doesn't say that absolutely specifically. I guess he could mean any kind of dissident. But, you know, he seems to be talking about Muslims. And then he describes them, the profile he's interested in to be rounded up is somebody who maybe their girlfriend broke up with them and they don't have a good job and they're not, and they kind of feel bad. And then maybe they, you know, choose ISIS, and he doesn't say what he means by choose ISIS. What, he likes something that they put on Facebook or retweet something or something? What does that mean? He chooses them. And then, but that's it. So, and he's saying, and then he refers to, you know, Snowden revelations and says, we have the ability to know how people are feeling and whether these kinds of things are happening to them and to know about this and whether, you know, and these, they have the right to feel that way. We have the right to separate them from the American people, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's just not true, right? For people who don't know, the Fifth Amendment, at least supposedly, is the law. And no, they can't separate you from your life, your liberty, or property without due process of law, which doesn't just mean a process that you do, as Stephen Colbert put it, as Eric Holder put it, justifying the assassination of Awlaki. It means hearings, and it means a Pettit trial before a jury. For any felony. So anyway, but you know, that's what he's claiming. He says, I'm tired of people pretending that sedition is protected speech. But of course, Thomas Jefferson and the Congress in 1800 repealed the Sedition Act. Right? Sedition is free speech. Brandenburg versus Ohio, the Supreme Court decision that upheld a Klansman saying, you know, promoting violent revolution against the government, saying, we're going to get some revengeance on you. And the court said, you can say that. What you can't do is lead a mob. Come on, let's get them. That is not protected speech. Hey, Ernie, I'll give you $50 to kill that guy for me. That is not protected speech, okay? An immediate incitement to violence or making a deal to commit a crime, that is not protected speech. Anything else is. Anything else is, including all of Washington, D.C., ought to be violently overthrown and driven into the sea.
Yeah, you know, driven says into the swamp. You.
That is protected speech in the United States of America.
Says
supposedly.
You. Supposedly. Says you. Says you.
Maybe it says the Supreme Court.
How many times do we ignore that? You know, see, this is, you know, this, I understand the argument and the principles behind it and what they're saying, but we have been just beaten into submission that executive order, you know.
Well, that's the thing. If we don't reaffirm the principle and say, whatever, screw you, government, all 300 million of us agree about the First Amendment, and so we don't care what you think. If we don't reaffirm that all the time, then Wesley Clark gets his way. Back to the point. He says this like it's no big deal, as though it's not controversial. The only reason it is controversial, Ernie, is because you and I insist that it is. That's it.
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of like the anti-CISPA, SOPA argument, or going to Syria or whatever. And the people rise up. They rise up. And sometimes you'll have some congressmen who will make notice and they'll delay it and kind of, we don't do it this week. And then here it comes again. And I'm going, all right, so what is it that we're having to do to stop this stuff? Well, we'll talk about that some more in the next hour. But when we come back, I definitely want to get, you know, to the dark continent. This is what's going on with China and Russia and them. You know, I remember in the 70s when you started having these two communist countries are always at each other's throat and never really were, you know, come together until we drive them together. And now they're doing joint military exercise. And then you have some joint military Russia and U.S. and China and U.S. and space stations. And this kind of crime. What the hell is going on? Who's making these decisions? What's the future? What's the driving force behind this? Now the BRICS have opened up a bank. You know, Brazil, Russia, whoever else, all these other guys. So I'm going, all right, so we have, the BRICS is out there starting to compete with the dot. What role does that play? I don't know. Hopefully Scott Horton's going to hit me out with it. We'll be back in the next hour with more Scott Horton. Scott, go ahead and give out your website for everybody.
ScottHorton.org.
ScottHorton.org. You know, Scott, ScottHorton. ScottHorton.org. And he's on right after this show on the LRN.FM network. We'll be right back with Scott Horton in just a little bit.
More Declare Your Independence is coming up next, live after the news, here on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM.
From Keene in the Shire, the Liberty Media capital of the world, this is Daryl W. Perry, host of FPP Radio News for Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015. Silver is trading at $14.75 per ounce. Gold is valued at $1,091 per ounce. And according to BitcoinAverage.com, the average price of Bitcoin is $279. Antiwar.com reports Pentagon officials are claiming that Mohsen al-Fadli, an al-Qaeda figure who they accuse of being the leader of the Khorasan faction, was killed in a U.S. airstrike earlier this month in the Aleppo province of northern Syria. U.S. officials have claimed Fadli was the target of several previous airstrikes against al-Qaeda and had speculated in the past that he was killed. Al-Qaeda's Syria faction, Jabhat al-Nusra, has not indicated whether or not the Kuwaiti-born Fadli was targeted or killed. When U.S. airstrikes target al-Qaeda forces in Syria, they usually attribute them as Khorasan figures, though it is widely acknowledged that the term Khorasan is itself a U.S. manufacturer and primarily used to try to convince Syrian rebels that Nusra, a top rebel force, is not being targeted. The U.S. seems somewhat less concerned with targeting Nusra in the recent months, however, since there are fewer and fewer U.S. allies among the rebels to begin with, except for a tiny U.S.-created faction that the U.S. has dubbed the New Syrian Force. For over 35 years, Roberts & Roberts has been a trusted source for buying and selling your investment-grade precious metals. They also take Bitcoin for precious metal purchases and permanently removed the minimum purchase order for all orders paid in the digital currency. Call Roberts & Roberts today for knowledgeable advice on investing and a forward-thinking approach to new technologies. 850-478-5270 or online at rrbi.co. We'll be right back. UPI reports an appeals court on Tuesday overturned four of Rod Blagojevich's corruption convictions, a ruling that may or may not result in less prison time for the former Illinois governor. Blagojevich was convicted in 2011 on 18 counts of corruption charges, including trying to sell the U.S. Senate seat of President Barack Obama. He was sentenced to 14 years in prison at a facility in Colorado. Judges with the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals overturned four of those convictions, saying that his attempt to appoint Valerie Jarrett in Obama's former Senate seat in exchange for a position on Obama's cabinet was a common exercise in log rolling. The ruling said this did not violate the law. In his appeal, Blagojevich's lawyers argued a number of errors were made by Judge James Zagel, including improperly instructing the jury about the law concerning fraud, extortion, and bribery. The overturned convictions could mean a reduction in sentencing for Blagojevich, though that may be unlikely. The Seventh Circuit Court's opinion said removing the four convictions does not affect the sentencing range. The judges also said Zagel's sentence in the first place was perhaps too lenient. ExpressCoin is the best choice for buying Bitcoin, Litecoin, Dogecoin, and more. ExpressCoin prides themselves on their customer service, so much so that the back end on the website should allow them to be even more focused on your needs. Get started at expresscoin.fppradio.com. That's expresscoin.fppradio.com. Reuters reports Facebook cannot challenge search warrants New York prosecutors used to get information from its site on hundreds of users suspected of Social Security fraud, according to a state appeals court on Tuesday, in a decision likely making it harder for New Yorkers to keep their digital lives private. The warrants, which applied to 381 users' photos, private messages, and other account information, could only be challenged by individual defendants after prosecutors gathered evidence, according to the Manhattan-based court. Facebook was backed in the case by a group of large internet companies, including Google and Microsoft, which argued the case could set a troubling precedent, giving prosecutors access to all kinds of digital information. Internet companies are pushing back broadly against U.S. intelligence and law enforcement agencies' demands for customer data in the wake of revelations by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden of wide-ranging online surveillance. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office served the warrants on Facebook in 2013, seeking information on dozens of people later indicted for Social Security fraud, including police officers and firefighters who allegedly feigned illness in the wake of the September 11, 2001 attacks. The world's biggest online social network turned the records over to prosecutors last year after a state judge threw out its claim that the warrants violated users' Fourth Amendment rights, but it also went ahead with the appeal. A Facebook spokesman said the company disagreed with the decision and was considering an appeal. This has been FPP Radio News, online at fppradio.com.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here!
Declare your independence from here. It's Hancock here in Phoenix, Arizona, A from the BEAUT Phil Studios of Freedoms of the Nass, freedomsphoenix.com. Scott Horton, scotthorton.org, anti-war radio. Here we go. Right after this show, you get to him, you get more and more and more. Oh, that's Scott, tell me, man. You got a special guest today. You got a show going on. What are you going to be doing? Are we so doing your show prep?
I got Jacob Hornberger is going to be on to talk about Cuba. And then I'm trying to get Michael Ratner about Wesley Clark and the concentration camp issue there.
That would be very interesting. Yeah, I'm liking this Cuba thing. I want to talk. You know, I tell you, I just saw it. Carnival Cruises is booking or putting together a cruise to go to Havana. So I'm going, Really? So I'm looking, I'm going, hey, man, that might be where I buy me some beachfront property, you know, get a deal. So we'll see how property rights go there and how that works out. But the they opened the embassy in Washington. What's your opinion?
Well, I mean, frankly, I'm afraid of any affirmative thing that the government does, right? I'm for them stopping doing horrible things that they're doing, but I am worried that they're going to try to, you know, steal the independence of the Cuban nation away from them, belong to us after stealing it from the Spanish back 100 years ago, 110, 115 years ago now. And so, that's really what they've been punished for this whole time, is not being communist, is being independent of the U.S. So I'm totally in favor of the end of the American Cold War against them. But if it's just a, you know, better, sneakier way to steal their country away, where it's not, you know, maybe little Ernie buying some beachfront property there, but American corporations going and buying up the whole damn island and basically out from under the people who live there, that kind of thing. Turning the whole thing into some kind of American corporate plantation or that kind of deal. I don't want to see that. I'd like
well,
to see
it's gonna
them
start
end their
with
independence.
It's going to start with the banking thing. You know it's going to start with banking. You know, they're going to, you know, oh, and now Visa. So I'm just, oh, and Greece, Greek islands, man, they're going up for sale. Everybody go, Johnny Depp got one. Warren Buffett got one. I mean, really? You know, they're going to get them some, you know, Aegean island fortress. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, if Cuba turns back into what it was, where it's got, you know, an American right-wing fascist dictator instead of a local left-wing commie one, that's not much of an improvement, I don't think.
Yeah, I think we're going to be paying attention to this. It's going to be interesting how this goes. You know, I tell you one thing that's going to really make a difference. I'm really going to pay attention to this, because we have had people from Cuba on and, you know, pimping, go to Cuba and Cuba's better now and you're allowed to have a barber shop and keep the money kind of thing. And I'm going, all right, what I want to know is how are we going to be able to keep track of this? And it's going to be internet. And I'm looking at the Cuban people. What happens when they get on the worldwide internet? It'd be like North Korea on the worldwide internet. What kind of social implications is that going to have? And they learn the history of a lot of things. I mean, even what they don't know about them or what we think. It's going to be very interesting to see the youth, a Levolution kind of movement of just awareness. Now, of course, they're going to try and control it and tell them what to think and what Miami says, Cuban refugees there, and tell them what's what. But I'm just going, as time goes on, I think there's going to be some interesting things happening in Cuba. Freedom's Phoenix. The Phoenix comes from what? Havana, Moscow, Detroit. I mean, you know where the ashes are. That's where it happens. You know, and before we get to the ashes in Africa, let's go ahead and talk about what's going on there. I really want to focus on Africa for a little bit. You know, tell me what's happening in Africa, and why was it that the United States, the empire, all of a sudden, it was just in the last decade, we decided we needed an Africa command? I mean, what was going on there?
All right. Well, so first of all, to back all the way up, Kangin Kodo's third person again, the American foreign policy doctrine is permanent, benevolent, global hegemony. And what that means is, if you read the national security documents, the national security strategy, Obama's is really no different than Bush's. Less focus on unilateralism, more focus on getting the Europeans to do our dirty work for us, working through the international institutions. But it's still the American empire, and it's still what it comes down to, basically, is that, in their words, this is from the 1992 defense planning guidance written up by Paul Wolfowitz, Zalmay Khalilzad, and Scooter Libby for Dick Cheney back then, that we will not allow any near-peer competitor or any combination of powers in the world that could ever even think to challenge us. So, in other words, Russia and China, mostly. We will do everything we can to keep them, to have a military that is so much more powerful than theirs that they won't even think of arming up to challenge us like it was back in the days of the Cold War. Because our advantage is just, you know, way too strong and whatever. Now, of course, this is a fool's errand, and they're bankrupting and destroying American society with this ridiculous plan of world empire. Carol Quigley could have told you the last stage of a civilization before it kills itself is world empire, when it overextends. And so same old game America's playing here. And now, but so in practice, what that means for the military, for the Pentagon, is that the Air Force and the Navy have their priority on pivoting to Asia. Let's contain China, because that's where their specialities are in play, right? Their
contain Navy. Them. And what do you mean contain them? How are you going to contain them?
Well, build up military assets all around them.
Well, they just build an island.
And hang tight to our alliances with all of the regional actors so that they can tripwire us right into war, I guess. And then it's a good way to sell airplanes and to sell this doctrine of air-sea battle, which is where the miraculously they think they talk about this like, this is such a cool deal. Check it out, Ernie. We can fight where the Navy and the Air Force actually can work together in one war. Like, this is a huge accomplishment for them. And they so want to build up their entire strategy for what to do with the world based on the theory of this air-sea battle. So, and the Marines, of course, have their part because they ride with the Navy. But the Army's left out. So the Army says, oh, yeah, well, then we get to pivot to Africa then. And that's kind of their way of keeping their jobs, you know, without having anything to do. And in fact, I even have here quotes where they're actually not ashamed, because they don't know that they're supposed to be ashamed, that there's any kind of, that they're proving the public choice theory or anything like this, when they say that, well, with the United States pulling out of Iraq and Afghanistan, the Army's looking for new missions around the world. And so that was the New York Times. And then the other one was even worse like that. We're looking for ways to stay engaged globally now that our rotations to Iraq and Afghanistan have ended. So, and then they repeat themselves backwards. We're looking for ways to stay globally engaged. So that's it. They don't want to have to get jobs. So they're looking for a place for some make work. And so Africa, well, there's a big place. And I guess it's, you know, against the rules now to kidnap the people and force them to work on your farms at gunpoint anymore. But we can go and take their resources from them and, you know, find excuses to create resistance and then fight that resistance. And
we have China as starting to put mobile artillery pieces on these, they call them reclaimed islands. Well, they just took dredges and piled up the sand and created their own freaking island out in the China Sea, and it's ours. And no, we got to have something to go up again. And then what happens? Oh, here comes the BRICS. They just opened it in Shanghai. We're going to talk about the economics of this in just a little bit.
While our satellite channel is free to listen to, it's not free for us. You can help us cover our satellite costs with the chip-in on the right side of the page at lrn.fm.
To be a part of the show, call 602-264-2800, 602-264-2800, and now, Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence. I'm Ernest Hancock. Scott Horton, scotthorton.org. Follows this show with Anti-War Radio, telling us what's up. They're going to be talking about Wesley Clark and his, everybody goes to a FEMA camp if you don't agree, you know, so they're going to be working on that. Also, Bumper Hornberger is going to be there talking about the Cuba deal. I'm interested in that. That would be interesting. I'd, you know, have that on while I am editing the show. You know, this is, the BRICS. This, what is it? Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. Okay, and they just opened up in Shanghai. Let's take a look here. Let's see, World Bank President Jim Yong Kim also welcomed the launch of the bank, saying the institutions have common goals. We are ready to work closely with the BRICS New Development Bank and other infrastructure banks to share our knowledge and to co-finance infrastructure projects. Such partnerships will be essential to achieve our common goals to eradicate extreme poverty by 2030, improve the well-being, and reduce the inequalities, he said, blah, blah, blah. Now, let me tell you, this was the mandate of the World Bank and IMF and all, you know, how did all your your oil underneath your sand resource and everything become ours. Well, we indebted you, and you put that up as collateral, and now you got a harbor, and all your goodies are ours now, and interest. So they're setting themselves up to do exactly what the IMF and the World Bank did. Well, they go, hey, man, they're making a bunch of money. We got a developing world of, hey, man, we can do our own, and we got Indonesia and Southeast Asia and China. We got all kinds of places we can do some money, like Africa. So I can see that this, will it merge eventually into the IMF and World Bank, and they're just negotiating for a seat at the mahogany table of we rule the planet? Or are they going to compete? And does that mean war between the banks? I mean, what's your opinion, Scott?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's just another example of the empire being self-defeating. As you put it earlier, where Russia and China, they hadn't gotten along. Kissinger and Nixon got in there and exploited that, you know, even while they were both still communist governments, and helped with that, with the Sino-Soviet split, as they call it. And there's a lot of tension over Siberia and its future, and there's plenty of reasons for them to not get along. And, you know, I remember a decade ago, Chalmers Johnson on my show saying, you know, in the Cold War, the idea of a Paris, Berlin, Moscow, Beijing axis was that world's, you know, worst absolute nightmare, was what they were trying to prevent. And now with our Middle East policy, and for that matter, our European policy, we're pushing them all together. And that was at the time when the Europeans were starting to sell weapons to China now, and this kind of thing. And the Russians and the Chinese were signing their big red treaty and all of this. And it was because of what America was doing. Now, so another aspect of the way the empire works is that economic hitman, like you said, where the loans from the IMF and the World Bank rarely, if ever, are meant to actually help with development. It's all just a way, you already described exactly how it works. They bribe a couple of government officials to make a deal on behalf of the entire population of a country. They get their money in their Swiss bank account and whatever, they're gone. And then they leave their entire population on the hook to pay it all back. And if they can't, then, oh, all your publicly owned resources now belong to us. Your oil, your water, whatever, whatever.
And austerity.
But what's happened is, guess what? I mean, this is the whole fantasy of the unipolar world. Well, I'm the big bully, and I can do whatever I want, and you can't stop me. Well, all that does is motivate everyone to come up with ways to stop you.
Right.
And so, or at least get around it. And so, this is part of the, this is why they hated Hugo Chavez so much. He never had a problem working with Shell Oil, working with Houston and the Cokes and whatever. That was all fine. What happened was he took his money out of the Fed and he made his own little IMF to loan money to the South American countries. And he didn't do it as a gangster just to trick them and to rape the population of their resources, et cetera. He just loaned them some money and cut the IMF basically out of all business in South America. And that was what got the target on him in the first place. And so, but now here's the catch for that. So assume for a minute that, Russia and China, or I guess it's founded by China, but it's basically all our European allies and everybody are in on this new IMF, the new Chinese-based IMF. If they don't have a policy of just going around trying to gangsterize everybody like the economic hitman, but they're really just making loans to for development, for profit, whatever, then they're going to sow, a lot more kind sentiment. They're going to, win more flies with honey and that kind of thing. They're doing the same thing in Afghanistan. As you mentioned, the same thing in Africa right now. They're walking around with briefcases full of cash and handshakes, and they're making deals instead of threatening everybody and bombing everybody all the time, which is the American way. So we've gotten away with it for so long. We think that works. And now, but on the other hand, we're still talking about government posing as businessmen and making economic decisions, which as libertarians, we understand they can't do because they don't have the right pricing structure to figure out what's a good deal and what's not and what's the proper interest rate and what's not. And so I can't imagine that this bank will be overall a success in, creating projects that end up being worthwhile for people in any of the countries where they're making these deals. But They certainly might, edge the IMF out if it appears, at least on the face, that they mean well anyway. They're not here just to, twist your arm behind your back and take all your stuff.
Well, how does the IMF take this is what happens when they started the World Bank, and I was always under the promise that they're going to help developing countries get the capital they need to blah, 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 blah. We'll exploit your resources and you get, you know, a highway you got to maintain in the jungle or something. So I'm wondering, we've had John Perkins on, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and several times, and it became, you know, pretty clear what was going on and the role that he played, and he's looking for absolution. But when you have the BRICS doing the same thing, they'll make the same promise, and they'll probably do it a little bit better for a while. But what's the overall goal? Is it to get out from under or provide competition, or there's a big giant opportunity, just this big monopoly around the planet of, we got a bank and we lend you into, you know, debt slavery, but we're going to do it a little bit better? Are they looking to make money on this, you know, to get their return, charge enough interest that they remain solvent? Or are they looking to, this is how they're going to buy up Africa using the IMF model? I mean, what's their plan?
Well, I think, like you're saying, at first, at least, I think probably the plan, I'm taking it more or less on face value. They want it to be a success. They want to loan money out, like you said. They want to operate like a giant transnational bank, loan money out, and make money back. Not necessarily, I mean, possibly, I don't know.
Loan what money?
It's in their minds,
but
I doubt that their plan is to just drive everybody into bankruptcy and steal all their stuff in the American way. Otherwise, they won't really be providing any competition to the IMF. They've got to treat people well, at least for a while, in order to mount an effective challenge, you know?
Well, then, if they go to Africa and they start doing this, which they're going to be doing, I'm wondering what they're going to be lending. You know what I mean? Is it going to be yuan? Is it going to be renminbi? Is it going to be, you know, rubles? Is it going to be dollars? Is it going to be cryptocurrencies? Are they going to be more innovative in the future of cryptocurrencies or alternative or metals or what? And they're hoarding a bunch of, getting a bunch and got a bunch of gold, you know, especially when it's low. I bet they're stocking up now. Yeah, that's an interesting thing, this gold deal, too. I mean, of course, they're not going to, you know, tell the West how much, you know, screw you, you know, your damn business. But the this is going to be, we're in a very interesting time in history. And this is, if you look back in history where it's, you know, competing financial interests like this and, you know, dominion over certain continents or the expansion of empire, blah, blah, blah. I can't remember a single time it didn't turn into a war.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're playing with fire, that's for sure. So far, mutual possession of nuclear weapons has prevented war, you know, full-scale war between major powers.
You know, which I'm looking
at. It's not a magical solution. It just happens to have worked so far. But then again, in only a very short blink of time, I mean, the era of atomic weapons is still only just a few decades old. So I don't think it's necessarily proven to work as an effective deterrent. It just seems as though maybe it is.
Yeah, until it's not.
You know what I mean? We don't have a control group.
Well, what do you think of the role North Korea is playing in all this? Anybody care? I mean, they're like double down and putting robots patrolling the demilitarized zone kind of crap. And I'm just
I don't think that they're going to do anything that's going to cross the Chinese. And the Chinese want stability in the region. I mean, it's really the Americans that are creating the most instability there.
Well, I mean, does the Chinese, are they saying, yeah, you can have Korean reunification. We don't give a crap.
I don't know about that. I think that they were for it. I think that when the South and the North were pursuing the Sunshine Policy, that the Chinese supported that. And although, to what degree, I really don't know.
Yeah, but what's the holdup?
They do have contrary interests there. I think they very well may prefer to keep the peninsula divided the same way the Americans do.
I'm wondering what the holdup is. You know, who's, I mean, of course, the U.S. side of, I have no idea.
The Americans have absolutely forbidden it. I mean, George Bush came in and stomped all over talks about reunification and sunshine and this and that.
Because
he created a nuclear crisis, and then he said, well, we got to resolve the nuclear crisis before we can talk reunification. So.
Okay, because what? We need North Korea because we need to have a on-the-shelf enemy or something? I mean, I don't understand why we care.
Well, we need to keep a recombined Korea from being an independent power in the Pacific that we're going to deal with. Right now, we have a South Korea that's dependent on us, which is the way we like it. But if they're combined, they have the population of the whole peninsula with the nuclear weapons of the North and the government and military of the South, then now they're basically, you know, almost on the level of Japan. I guess it'd take a little while to adjust for the North.
Well, I mean, we saw this happen with East and West Germany. I mean, it'll happen, you know, but
it'll happen. Yeah, and so the Americans don't want that.
Yeah, but when you see the American, is this in Washington? Is it political parties? Is it the banks? Is it the military industrial? I mean, who are we talking about here?
Well, loosely speaking, it's the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies, the military industrial complex, and then, yeah, I guess the banks too. I don't know how much.
There's a difference between all of them?
They have direct influence on North Korea policy, but in general, that's the foreign policy establishment. That's who you got to deal with. And of course, when I say think tanks, a lot of that means Israel.
Yeah. What the hell does Israel give a crap about North Korea?
Oh, no. Well, I don't think they do. I mean, they pretend to care that North Korea trades with Iran and trades missile tech with Iran and that kind of thing. But it's all a bunch of hype, really.
All right. Coming back 10 seconds. Here we go.
Help get LRN.FM into more ears. Visit promote.lrn.fm for a free bumper sticker, flyers, banners, graphics, and more. Promote.lrn.fm.
Rhodes? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
Anti-war radio. This is what I'm really interested in is the future. You know, how is this all playing out? Because it's all like orchestrated, manipulated, and marionettes, puppets on strings. Kind of, this is what we're going to do because we say, and I know it's true because it was on Fox News, kind of crap. And I'm going, you know, who kind of plows through that and picks out the truth and gets an idea of where we're going and why? Well, a lot of times it's economics. You know, it's going to be, you know, why do you fight these wars? Why do empires go? Because they want what they want when they want it. And if you're in the way, well, we got, you know, an aircraft carrier for that. So we look at things in the Middle East, you know, it's kind of, you might as well say Africa. It's next to, I mean, you know, Somalia is Africa, and right across the Red Sea there, you got, you know, Yemen, you know, so you're going, okay, Libya is on the radar screen now. We need to have a bunch of a base. That was one thing they were saying. We need to have some kind of a military base to be able to launch our control over Libya. What was that about, Scott?
I'm sorry, which was the question again? I was looking at this thing where they're speculating that Sandra Bland was already dead in her mugshot. Sorry, I was distracted. Twitter got me, man.
Yeah, I'm talking about Libya. Well, I mean, and you know, I want to get into drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia and all this. You know, it's just it's more of the same, but I'm looking at Libya. They're wanting to have some place. They were talking about they need a base from operations to operate a drone "We Rule You" war against Libya.
Mm-hmm.
You heard anything about that? I mean, what's that about?
Well, I mean, the major drone base for East Africa is in Djibouti. And
where's that? What is Djibouti?
And I guess they have a drone base in Chad for attack in Boko Haram down in Nigeria and attacking the jihadists in Northern Mali. If there's current drone strikes going on against Libya, I don't know of them or where they're flying from. Although, you know, they have the Navy in the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay, I'm putting on here a Libya base, and I bet you to come up and search and see. Blah, 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 blah. Now blows up. We want secret American base in Libya reportedly seized Libya. I remember.
Well, are you talking about from a few months back?
No, I was here recently. U.S. seeks drone base in North Africa to combat IS in Libya. That's what I'm talking. This is July 13th. So,
okay,
you know,
so maybe that's a new one going in Algeria or something.
Well, I don't, you know, I mean, just the fact that they would even bring up Libya, you know, like we've got some kind of threat from Libya. We're going to need a base in Africa because of Libya. Washington
well,
and talks
the head
to
of the Islamic State there. It's Belhaj, who there's pictures of him meeting with John McCain, call them a moderate rebel, no jihadist, even though he was already on the record. Everybody already knew. We talked about it on my show in the early part of the war. that this guy was a part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq during Iraq War II, and how, you know, here America's taken the side of the jihadists. Then these guys, they announced Sharia law and they awarded John McCain their Medal of Sharia or whatever the hell it was. This guy now is the leader of the Islamic State affiliate in Libya. And they're fighting a civil war over there. America's trying to, now they switch back to the secular fascists. They're trying to install the next Gaddafi. This guy, Haftar, who's working for the CIA, lived in Virginia, just outside of Langley for 30 years or something.
And yeah, now, so basically
now they're trying to take backsies. Oops, we didn't mean to fight a war for Al-Qaeda against a secular commie dictator, Gaddafi, so now let's put a new one in there. And it's not working. In the whole country, there'll never be such a place as Libya again, I don't think.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and I'll give you just a little tidbit here. TimesOfIsrael.com. All right, here it is. The United States is in talks with countries in North Africa to set up a base for unmanned aerial vehicles on their territory to improve surveillance and intelligence gathering on the Islamic State terror group, which means, yeah, drones too, with armed, which has gained a significant foothold in chaos-ridden Libya. Now, of course, they don't say who started the chaos or why there's chaos. There's just chaos there. We got to go kick ass.
Right.
Washington and its allies against the Islamic State would like to see the terror group contained to Iraq and Syria, where it already controls large swaths of territory, according to Wall Street Journal. Right now, what we are trying to do is address some real intelligence challenges, a senior U.S. official told the paper. Washington wants to fill gaps in our understanding of what's going on, blah, 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 so we can go kick ass later and whatever. So, you know, this is, you know, it's just more of the same, and it doesn't matter what they caused some kind of ruckus, and they never mention how they sent the country into civil war, and it's desolate, and it's bombed, and it's, you know, I'm just going, and you look at Yemen, a lot of the photographs from Yemen, it looks like Hiroshima. I mean, it's not like you got a bombed little thing. It's like, you know, Gaza and Yemen and Hiroshima and Dresden is kind of looking the same. It's just to lay waste to people and killing thousands and thousands and wonder why you have terrorists. And I'm going, it seems like it's almost on purpose.
Well, you're certainly right. They never explain how it got this way or even who's on whose side. I mean, you can't get... you know, I read a little thing, I didn't watch it, but I read a little thing about John Stewart and Obama where he said, he did point out, we're fighting with the Iraqi Shia and Iran against the Islamic State in Iraq right now, but we're fighting against, he didn't say for Al-Qaeda, but he could have, and against the Iranian-backed Houthis, although they're barely backed by Iran, really, in Yemen, and he could have said, and still we're insisting on the overthrow of the Shiite, Ba'athist, secular dictatorship in Syria, which can only benefit al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, and the Islamic State. He wouldn't go that far, but that little rant of John Stewart confronting Barack Obama right there, that's as close as you'll get. I don't think you could find, if you got fairness and accuracy in reporting or whatever, to rewind, you know, the last 10,000 hours of CNN, ABC, NBC, whatever. I don't think you could find anybody explaining contradictions in American policy like that, explaining who is who at all like that.
Or Scott, and I think Horton,
if you just showed
radio?
The, if you went to the local Rotary Club or whatever and just said, look, here are the different battles going on and here are the different sides that America is on in this, they would be, I mean, if you could convince them you weren't kidding, they would be outraged. You know, what's happening actually, it's not just that it's horrible, it's that it's clearly and obviously contradictory and self-defeating and horrible and violent and wasteful and can't possibly succeed in the stated goals. And it's that plain to anyone if they just have it explained to them, which TV never does.
You know, let's go ahead and do some predictions a little bit. We're getting into, you know, last segment here. And I want to, before we get to the break, let's kind of preface it this way. We have the 2016 election cycles coming up. We have the European Union about ready to fold in on itself. We have, you know, the U.S. dollar is kind of strong because everything else just, you know, sucks more, but that doesn't mean anything. And we have gold getting, you know, pummeled. You have China buying it all up, starting their own currencies, their own banking system.
building their own islands, having influence on Africa. Libya's in the news again. Yemen's getting laid waste to. Syria's not going to go away. ISIS is doing it. I mean, you have all these things going on, and I'm wondering what country or what conflict is going to rise to the top, you know, in the 2016 election cycle and the debates and so on. You got any kind of clairvoyant prediction?
Well, as far as the politics of it go, I think we're going to see more ridiculous imperial comedy as these guys take both sides and against both sides in the sectarian war going on over there. And I don't mean to imply that they're fighting over who believes what branch of Islam. That's not what it is. It's power factions, but those are the dividing lines of, you know, the so-called Shia Crescent, Iran, Damascus, Hezbollah, oh, and Baghdad, versus everybody else. And because Israel hates the Shia more, especially the Republicans are completely confused in trying to oppose ISIS and all of ISIS's enemies, too.
Well, we'll just ask John McCain, who we're supposed to support.
Oh, yeah, good
luck. He'll tell us.
Great answer out of him.
We'll be right back. Okay, what I wanted to do in this last segment, well, go ahead and give me some of the things that you want to make sure gets included before you go.
Well, I guess ask me about Ukraine. That's the one thing we haven't really covered, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Ukraine.
Right?
Yeah, Ukraine. The other thing is...
there's Afghanistan and Pakistan, too, but...
Afghanistan, Pakistan, some other stands. Okay, the one thing that I'm going to come back and kind of open it up with is a quick story I told before, but I want to get it on the show with you. Is I was vacationing with some people this summer, and a lot of guys, you know, resources, been around the world, have, you know, and a different perspective, you know, going around. And a gentleman was visiting them with another guy and came and to give a gift to his host and hostesses. He stopped at in Seattle Airport, or up in Washington State. He stopped in the airport, and he went to the map store. And he thought, yeah, that's kind of cool. You can get some cool maps, globes, whatever. So he got these little globes, that kind of just rubber ball, squishy thing. And it had, you know, the countries colored on it and everything. And then he had another one. It was a blow-up one. It's by 18-inch diameter that you just blow up. And it was kind of a cool, you know, globe you'll hang in a kid's room or something. And it was just a view of the Earth with the clouds and so on from space. And the host, he goes like this. He goes, yeah, I like that one without the gang colors. And I'm going, wow, what a way to put it. You know, it's just a right. Gangs with the flag and the gang colors and the separating the borders of gang colors. And I'm going, man, that kind of, you know, slapped me in the face. I'm going, yeah, the maps with the gang colors, you know. I'm going, oh, that's good. So when we do that, you know, I'm going to kind of tell that story real quick, take me 30, 40 seconds, and then we'll go into, let's talk about the, you know, the changing gang colors and the borders and who did those borders. How did that happen? And we have the problems in, you know, in Europe and Afghanistan and Pakistan, a million. So that's what I'm going to throw it to you, and you can kind of, you know, because you said, made me think of that. You said something about European lines in the Middle East kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what we're
yeah
gonna do.
Well, sure. I mean, of course, I hope the audience doesn't think you're a one world communist now or something. I mean, just because you're pointing out how artificial it is to have 192 nation states doesn't mean you want one nation state.
We'll talk about it. I don't need them telling me what the state is. Here we go.
This is the Liberty Radio Network, broadcasting the latest liberty oriented audio content 24 hours a day at lrn.fm.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence, rock and roll and whatnot with some Dubé brothers. Yep, you know, I always like that song. I was vacationing, and we were with some friends, and they traveled the world and all that kind of stuff. And it was some common friend that was a guest there brought a friend, a guest with them to meet everybody and so on. He's a cool guy. And he thought it appropriate to get a gift for his host and hostesses, and he stopped at a map store inside the Seattle airport. And he got two little globes that, you know, kind of had the countries colored on it. And it was just like a squeezy ball thing, like a fidgety on your desk deal kind of deal. And then he got another one. It was a blow up, like 18 inch, you know, diameter blow up like a beach ball that had the Earth from the view from space. And the immediate comment is the host said, yeah, I like that one better. The one without the gang's colors. And I'm going, wow, that just, you know, boom, slapped me upside the head. Because you look at all the globes that we have around here, and we got grandkids and so on. We have some nice ones that are inlaid stone kind of thing on a black back. I mean, just kind of cool stuff. But they're always having, you know, states or countries or something like that. And do we, are we indoctrinating, you know, our kids into thinking, you know, yeah, which country, what flag do you salute? You know, I mean, so I'm going, ah, man, I, you know, gang colors. Well, these borders, who decided this? Where'd this come from? There's all kinds of little deals of Louisiana purchased and took away from Santa Ana and Texas and, you know, America, kind of what native tribe is not theirs anymore kind of thing. But, you know, throughout the Middle East, it was done in other ways by other people. Scott, you know, help me out here. You understand what I'm talking about? Where do these lines come from?
Well, yeah, most of them were drawn by the European powers. I mean, the modern nation state was really invented by the Treaty of Westphalia in 16-something, whatever the hell, I forget. And so then, you know, they just divided up their territories across Africa and across Central Asia. And the name of the game is divide and conquer. So the lines aren't just in the wrong places as far as, you know, if you want to be a collectivist about it at all and talk about nations of people in some of these places. You know, maybe there are enough differences between the Turkmen and the Kazakhs that they're kind of are different countries. But you know the lines aren't in the right place because the lines were drawn by some limey goon. And so you look especially at Afghanistan and Pakistan right now where, you know, Afghanistan, one of the reasons that Afghanistan is always in turmoil is because you have the basically an alliance of the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and the Hazaras against the Pashtuns. And the Pashtuns, they're basically divided. Their land is basically shaped like a J all along the Afghan-Pakistan border. You know, in eastern Pakistan down into the south, into where, I don't know if you know the shapes of them, but Pakistan is sort of shaped like a J itself, and Afghanistan is kind of sitting in it. And so, but anyway, all along that line, it's called the Durand line. It was drawn by the British to divide the Pashtun people, to make it harder for them to resist. And so, you know, on this side of the line, these guys get some favors while we fight those guys and this kind of thing and, you know, divide them. And so it's funny because, the imperialists, the American imperialists will use this as an excuse sometimes. There was a thing where in the Air Force, Armed Forces Journal, something a few years back, where they drew a new map of Eurasia and said, well, here's where the border should really be. Here's, you know, southern Iraqi Shiistan, and here's Sunnistan, and here's Pashtunistan, and here's what Iran's border should look like. And people over there flipped out. I think Afghanistan didn't even exist anymore in the redo there. Of
well, they were probably happy with that.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, in some cases, I mean, the point is, first of all, it's none of America's damn business to fix this, but it is kind of a recognition that, you know, well, it's kind of flawed, too, right? I mean, I'm an individualist. I'm like you. I don't believe in these borders and flags, and I don't really believe in all this, you know, that old ethnicities and nationalisms should, you know, determine how people behave and interact with each other now. And so really, if everybody just believes in individualism, it shouldn't matter where the lines are because everybody has such a limited state that its only job is protecting their rights. And so who cares? But of course, that's not really the way of the world. And especially in the old world, you know, history and ethnicity are the curse forever. That's why so many people fled to North America to kill the Indians and live on their land instead, was to get the hell out of the constant strife of people fighting over territory and fighting over who's who in the old world. And so, yeah, it's a damn mess. Same thing for Africa, of course, as well.
Yeah,
so
Africa's going to be...
America broke off South Sudan, and then South Sudan immediately broke off into civil war between the two biggest tribes in South Sudan.
The Africa went through the same thing. Africa is, I don't know who, never, British Empire, the Dutch, the Portuguese, everybody, you know, want to get their, the French, you know, they want to get their say in their resources and their railroads and whatever they're going to do. And these lines go right through tribes. They go right through natural borders. They go right through. I'm wondering what the rationale and your research on this and war and the factions of, what was their mindset? It's just convenience? I mean, it just, I got a ruler? Look, I mean, what were they?
If you're a foreign power and you want to rule a foreign country, then what you do is you support a minority group to rule the majority. That way they need you. And that way that you create enmity between the two groups and incentives for people to side with the foreigners. And this is why it made sense for Ronald Reagan. I'm not saying it was moral or anything. I'm saying it made imperial sense to support Saddam Hussein. He could use the foreign support. He was, you know, a member of the 20% Sunni minority ruling over 60% supermajority Shia population, another 20% Kurds. And so it makes sense, right, for it to have the populations divided and ruled that way and support the minority ruler over the majority.
Wow, I never heard of that concept before. That's awesome. Yes, so you're saying throughout history and countries and this and who, and we're always, whether it's Vietnam or Korea or Yemen or anywhere.
Nam's
in the Middle
a perfect
East.
Example, right? Support the Catholic minority in the South against the Buddhist majority that are, you know, more or less favor communism and nationalism under Ho Chi Minh over foreign white rule under the Catholics.
Okay, so you can look for when they do, like Libya, you know, it's in turmoil. They'll finally have a significant thuggish minority of somebody that's willing to do their bidding and will install you, putting you in power and support you, and we'll help you rule everybody else, and you gotta need us and sign here, and our your oil became ours.
The same thing happened in the South after the Civil War, where the Northern occupying army put blacks in Congress and in positions of power, but then, of course, left them high and dry after a few years. And so then there was a huge backlash from that. But they put the people who were grateful to have them there in power in order that they could get away with what they were getting away with.
Wow. You know, that never occurred to me. That, you know, as a mechanism that you give support to the minority so that, you know, because they need you. And, you know, wow.
Yeah, remember
that,
in Rwanda where it was the Tutsis versus the Hutus? Mm-hmm. Well, there was no such thing, really. They were an invention of the European powers who said, you know, the ones of you who are taller and skinnier and remind us more of Europeans, we like you. And everybody who's shorter and squatter, well, you're the inferior Hutu tribe, or where you're on, you, the majority, are on the outs. And you will be permitted to suck up to us. And so they had, you know, enough of the people who, hey, they were conquered after all. So, you know, some people in the prison become trustees, and then you use them against everybody else.
Wow. Now, this is, before we go, I mean, in the last, I mean, we can talk for a minute, but after, but I'm just here in the U.S., you know, what's your prediction on the election probably? You're thinking it's Jeb? That's it?
Oh, it's definitely Jeb. Unless, well, now, here's the thing. My standard answer for that has been, well, it's Jeb unless he really screws up and says the N-word in front of an open microphone or something like that, in which case, you know, bad things can happen. He could really sabotage himself. But he has the entire establishment lined up. Every power faction that's important. The banks, the insurance companies, the Israelis, oil, agribusiness, all of that. But then there's Trump. And Trump is the wild card in this thing, man. So He could ruin it for Jeb.
You know, I see that people that have been around long enough. I was heavily involved and had our election lawsuits and all that kind of stuff in 92 when Perot came in. And I was paying close attention there. I spoke at different events, you know, just to, you know, I want to have the opportunity to follow my sword to vote, to not vote for Perot, because I don't care. I want the opportunity to not vote for him. And now I'm like, yeah, you're still voting. What the heck? But, you know, I'm seeing that it's the same kind of mentality. It's anybody but another Bush or Clinton. And I'm wondering if that's the biggest Trump card he has. We'll find out.
Why did you?
Thanks, Scott, for spending the day with me. That was awesome.
Thanks for having me, man. I always like talking with you.
Well, this is, you know, keeping, you know, all the things that we talked about are just going to be, you know, revisited the next time we do. So, I mean, I'm sure that's, you know, what's going on in Africa, the BRICS, China and Russia doing their whatever. And I can't see a real consistent message from the U.S. except for the first time I am seeing a lot of insertion in the media by officials at the Pentagon. It's like the Pentagon itself has its own PR department that's not the president. And I'm wondering, when the hell has that happened before?
I don't know.
I mean, you understand what I mean? I mean, you know, Pentagon says this about that, and I'm like, since when did they get to have a say? Who gave them some kind of policy manipulation of press release?
It's the same thing with the cops all the time, man. They're not even embarrassed. They have no idea. They're perfectly proud to act as though they are a legitimate constituency of the population who get to have what they want. When, no, you're the armed enforcers, servants of the people, supposedly, and you don't get to have a say. You don't like it, lump it.
Yeah,
but they act like, you know, their
opinion matters. What they're going to rule.
The state created us. They allow us to exist to protect their authority. You know, that's it. To serve it, to obey it.
Yeah, I'm. We need to talk more often. It's going to start getting funky when we get into the 2016. You know, one thing that Donna was asking, a lot of the guys are at a pool party Saturday, and a lot of the activists are going, well, you guys are going to do debate parties. And I'm like, I mean, not the way that we did before. I mean, you know, it'd just be an opportunity to just hang and make fun of whatever and have a drinking game or something. But, I mean, you know, every time they say Islamofascism, you got to, you know, do tequila or something. But, I mean, other than that, I mean, I just don't care.
Yeah, but there's no Ron to cheer for this time, that's for sure.
Yeah, anything. It's just so, ew. All right, well, you know, stay in touch, man. I'm glad you're coming on after. That makes it awesome.
Yeah, man.
All right. Peace, brother.
All right. Thanks again, dude.